listening to the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Get on.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Cold River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. By God, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid!
Well, howdy! All right, we're all set. Usually I banter a little bit before getting into the full swing of the show, you know that. But tonight we're going to go straight to the meat of the program. Even the music's been inspected. John Fox crafted that intro in an attempt to make sure that not one single note had ever been played by either Billy Joel or the Grateful Dead, and they haven't. We're serious about this. This is a professional operation. I first became aware of Anthony Bourdain a long, long time ago on a cable network, probably not far enough away from Mr. Bourdain's liking. From the first episode, well, I was hooked. You know me well enough to know that No Reservations is literally the only TV show I make a conscious effort to watch. Hell, back when we were doing the horn section, I had my contract stipulate that I got Monday nights off. I actually know when those No Reservations airs, and I've been known to stay up late to catch the rerun. I even sat down to an episode of Yo Gabba Gabba with my granddaughter when Tony was on. Yeah, I'm a fan. Why? Well, because in an entertainment industrial complex world awash in reality shows that are anything but, Anthony Bourdain is as much as television can be, real. So's his writing. From Kitchen Confidential through A Cook's Tour and The Nasty Bits, I've enjoyed every printed word. Even more than the television, it's proven thought-provoking. In an era when even the news, the staple of my existence, is as often vapid as it is substantive. So we come tonight to Mr. Bourdain's new book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, out this summer from Echo Press, a HarperCollins imprint. This is much more than a food book. And Anthony Bourdain is much more than a guy who writes about food. Anthony Bourdain, welcome to the Horn.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm just tickled pink. Let me ask just to get things get going. Medium Raw is full of observations that let readers know that you sort of suspect that what you're doing is a kind of a fleeting transient. bigger stuff out there. You've just gotten back, as I understand from your publicist, from what I hope was a relaxing and pleasant vacation. And you come back to see your beloved New York City and the rest of the country embroiled over a tempest in a teapot over the Muslim equivalent of a YMCA with lots of folks who know less than, you know, about New York than a hillbilly like me. Do you just want to run screaming back to JFK and get on the plane?
Yeah, man. I don't know. I mean, intolerance, being a territorial, intolerant, jingoistic, xenophobic, tribalism. I mean, that's something I see a lot of around the world. But it's unlovely to see, in my hometown. I mean, to his credit, our mayor has been very cool about it, to come down on the right side of the issue. Yes, of course, it's enraging him, but yes, I want to run right back to where I was. I want to go right back to Italy.
Well, it just occurred to me because there was a strange irony in the fact that the last new episode of No Reservations that aired before this conversation, last week's episode, was Dubai.
Yeah.
And it has to, of course, you know, that's long ago old history in your book, but there has to be something odd insofar as you meet people who are really decent human beings all around the globe, and it comes out in your work. And to see this kind of thing going on in this country has got to be a little bit unsettling.
Well, like I like to say a lot, I mean, I don't have to, you know, I don't have to agree with you to like you or respect you. In fact, I could disagree violently with what you have to say, and I feel I could still sit down, have a decent meal, we could get along and hopefully respect each other. I think that's the same thing in my heart that allows me to sit down in Saudi Arabia and have dinner with people and at least try and see their point of view to whatever extent I can, you know, allows me to be friends with Ted Nugent, frankly. I don't see any difference between the two. I, you know, people go berserk and get a lot of angry mail when we shoot a very sympathetic program in Laos, talking about what happened there during the Vietnam War and the effect it's had on people since. I get a lot of howls from the couch Rambos, but I have to say that the wails and screams of horror and outrage whenever we have Ted Nugent on the show are at least as loud and at least as crazed. So you know, it just seems like the level of discourse in the country as a whole has gotten so cartoonish as to avoid a basic like civility.
So I take it then from what you just said that I'm not the only one that reads some sort of relevance, and I don't want to sound like some guy who plays records backwards or anything, but that sees some sort of relevance in your work that transcends, if I may, mere issues of food.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't have any political agenda when I go to a country or to do a program at all. But when you sit down, I mean, but by the same token, I'm not going to avoid the elephant in the room. I mean, you learn a lot about a culture by what people are eating, how hospitable they are, literally what's on your plate. It tells you a lot about, you know, what people love, about their culture, where they came from. But it also tells you that if, you know, 80% of their diet is bread, you know, that's, you might want to mention why. If your host is missing, you know, three of his four limbs, it's worth asking the question, you know, gee fella, you know, where'd your limbs go? You know, that alone is a political act. You know, eating is a political act even. So, I guess that's had to kind of leach into the show. And then in the course of making the show, I'm just out there looking to, you know, get drunk, have a good time and eat. You know, I've been in a few uprisings, insurrections, you know, civil problems and even a war. So those things do kind of get up and in your face.
Well, and both your TV work and your writing, and I hope you will not take this as an insult, has journalistic qualities to it. And I say not take it as an insult mainly because so much of journalism is insulting these days. That journalistic quality, you come back to America from all these varied and different places, and in Medium Raw, you address issues as varied as the state of the American hamburger. The fact that even so-called foodies, very few of them can actually cook, whether kids need organic gardens in the back of the in the back of the elementary school, or whether they need to be able to know that they're not going to get shot going to school that day. All of this started, if I understand your sort of autobiography correctly, with a fairly simple piece for the New Yorker. Was the urge to report always underneath it all, or were you just getting it off your chest?
I think I'm a bit of a provocateur. I think I just kind of can't help that. I think that goes back to it's a childish and childhood impulse. I like to point out the obvious. It seems so many people don't. I just started out writing about my life, you know, like Frederick Forrest said in, Apocalypse Now, I'm just a cook, man. I just want to cook. But I was given the opportunity to talk about my life, and that went well. And then people let me travel around the world eating and drinking and making television about it. And really all I wanted to do was report on food. I tell my crew all the time, hey, I'm not Dan Rather here. You know, we're not here to sum up the history of this country or make any kind of commentary. But I do have the luxury of I don't have to neatly sum things up, which is quite a nice privilege. I mean, I can say, as we did at the end of the recent Liberia show. I don't really understand what's going on here, and I don't know how I feel about it. I'm a little freaked out. I'm a little uncomfortable. I'm a little upset. That in itself is a privilege.
Well, the fact that you are willing to let that discomfort show through, I think speaks volumes about why so many people think so highly of your work and that of your crew and your team. When you look back at what you've done and what has been the seedbed of your writing, and because I get this idea, you seem very comfortable and very reverential around people and their local food, and you've done a great deal in terms of teaching people that the origins of stuff that they're paying $30 a plate for is actually peasant food from the interior of some heartland somewhere. Are you more comfortable around the workaday working stiff, whether it be in Ho Chi Minh City or?
I come out of the fine dining business, all my friends are chefs, and I'm very privileged. I spent a lot of my life eating in fancy, expensive fine dining restaurants around the world. The places that give me pleasure that are the most fun, just because I'm a jaded guy for whom fine dining was business, and just as somebody, I guess, for whatever reason, I mean, I'm just happier more often than not, you know, eating street food in Vietnam or at a taco stand in Mexico than I am sitting bolt upright with a tie around my neck choking me in a restaurant.
I don't think I've ever seen that be made more manifest than the Dubai episode last week. The British expat with whom you were having dinner, I swear, Tony, I think I saw you a couple of times looking for exit signs in Arabic.
Well, it was an exquisitely uncomfortable conversation for the both of us, I think, because he was not enjoying my questions, and I was not really enjoying the restaurant. But, I mean, on the other hand, I feel I can be an angry guy, and I'm angry when I see food fetishized. I'm angered by the kind of elitism I see. I mean, food has become very, very, you know, people are passionate about food. Most of the country, people are passionate about it in an emotional way. It's not really so political. But when people are dogmatic about food, when people are telling me, you know, you must eat this, you should eat that way, you know, your food must be organic, we must support local. You know, especially when it's somebody, you know, driving an expensive car, making $150,000 a year. I just that troubles me. You know, I don't like that.
Well, organic's all well and good, but how's a mom feeding a family of five gonna make it to the Wild Oats or whatever store and pay $22 a pound for grass-fed or organic free-range beef that died comfortably in Montana?
Yeah, I'm all for all of those things. I really am. But, I mean, you know, those are options for people who can afford. You know, to the extent that we can make those things affordable, great. But I'm not going to make people feel bad about themselves if they, you know, all they have time for in their working lives or all they have the money for is Popeye's fried chicken.
I hate to admit, but of all the fast food in the world, I like Popeye's best of all. But
you know what? I love their macaroni and cheese. It's utterly disgusting. I'm not even sure there's even cheese in it, but I have an unholy weakness for that stuff.
I put a bag
over my head and sneak out and get some of that stuff now and again. I'm always recognized coming out the door, too. It's like, dude!
With the trench coat and...
They get caught, you know, coming out of a porn shop.
And some of the southern Popeyes actually still sell fried chicken livers. And,
oh, man.
And that's just, it's evil, and I know it, and the God knows the chickens were probably tortured to death, but they're good. And you're absolutely right. You can't, the dogma stuff is annoying to the point of infuriation. And I can't help wondering, with your travels and who you've talked to, the fetishization of food, has it become, or is it rapidly becoming, another one of those little boxes that the rest of the world gets to check off to show, you know, how much the industrialized world is deserving of the apocalypse?
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I really wonder, you know, and whether these people are, or we're all just preaching to the converted here. You know, you don't win hearts and minds like this. By convincing people of the, how great a you know, a perfect radish is, well, you know, that's great, but you're also driving the price up. I don't know how I feel. I mean, I'm guilty of it. I mean, I write food porn. I make food porn on television. I'm guilty of fetishizing food. I do it regularly and enjoy it. I just don't know whether ultimately it's good for the world or not.
Well,
I don't know what balance it is. I think it's even more troubling when you see how, you know, now, you know, in order to find like tripes or chitlins or pork belly or, you know, cheeks and jowls and hooves and snouts, you know, the rich people are paying $32 a pop for that stuff in fine dining restaurants. You know, those are all dishes that the poor used to have to eat and are running away from as fastly and as furious as they can get away. And yet we've, you know, those of us who are more comfortable are rediscovered them and tend to wax poetic about them. So I don't know what this means.
Nor do I. But the thing is, I think you recognize and you make clear in Medium Raw that some of these things actually are deadly serious. That the praise that you offer for Jamie Oliver, I found interesting just because of his willingness to go and crusade in the face of what he knows he must be throwing away in terms of endorsements.
And the fact that I think it's probably a doomed cause. I mean, I admire anyone who embarks on a doomed cause, but this one in particular, I mean, I think there are plenty of other things he could have done with his life, but he's chosen to do this. I really admire.
Well,
and we need it. I mean, it's, you know, we need only look around. I guess my argument with him, it's not even an argument because I really admire what he's doing and how he's doing it. But if I were so inclined as to try and make the same argument, I think, as I point out in the book, I would be taking the low road.
Well, that does carry over into the next question, though, because, you know, you say you think it's a lost cause, and you don't, and I take it that you don't mean just for Jamie Oliver. You don't want to be a food fascist or a fat fascist or anything like that. It's repugnant to you. People should be able to make their own choices, but the question that occurs, at least in the context of the United States, because the European Union is by far a very different animal where all of this sort of thing is concerned. But when McDonald's and Cargill can purchase their own personal senators to make sure that people don't get to make reasonable food choices, what's left?
Well, I think, you know, working through publishing calorie count and health, you know, information clearly is not working, okay? This has had zero impact on America's thighs or on their health. You know, we know it's killing us. We know it's making us morbidly obese, and that is in no way changing behavior. I don't think hectoring people, offering the intellectual argument, I think, unfortunately, I would attack this problem the way the FBI, attacked, the left and the Panthers. I would use something like the COINTELPRO program, you know, a black propaganda, terrorize people, divide and conquer, every nasty, dirty, low trick that we can think of to demonize, terrorize, marginalize, fearmonger, people into changing their behavior. I think that's unfortunately the way to go. And, a passing of false rumors. Hey, that's the way to,
it worked for their side.
Everyone else fails, point out that, you know, it's unpatriotic what they're doing to our country. You know, how are we going to raise a fighting force if all of us are morbidly obese?
And, you know,
we're going to meet them in the beaches, you know?
Yeah, somewhere in the Pentagon, there's some lieutenant colonel who is poring over a smoking keyboard right now, trying to sort exactly that out with a $3.3 million budget for doing so.
Yeah.
Without a doubt, the Ronald McDonald Black Ops segment in Medium Raw is probably the single best comic piece, if you will. I've read it to my family. The whole family's huge fans. We're just sad here. I've read it to them, and they all laughed. And the idea of painting Ronald McDonald as some sort of dastardly denizen of the sewers is frankly brilliant. There are real world things that go with that, though. You mentioned that process whereby meat is turned into or scraps are turned into usable meat by virtue of a centrifuge and some household ammonia or something. The USDA the number of inspectors from that movie Food Inc., the number of USDA inspectors from 1976 to now is like, you know, 100 down to 1. Nothing's left but the little purple USDA meat stampers. With all of these things taken together, is there any way to teach without being dogmatic?
Well, I think in this case it's just you're scaring people away. The only way is to terrify and scare people away from it. I mean, we managed to eradicate. You'll notice, I don't know, but what the school system's down there. Try finding a peanut butter sandwich in the school system in New York State or California. It ain't going to happen because, you know, little Hunter might have a peanut allergy. They've effectively removed that cherished staple of childhood from the entire school system. And in much the same way, I think if you, how hard is it to scare a 3-year-old, you know?
Well, very true. And I guess the question is how difficult is it, to scare little Hunter's mommy?
Yeah, and I think that we've proven if you just see the enormous explosion in people are clearly willing to pay more, those who can afford it, even those who can't, for what they perceive as healthier or cleaner food. So it's possible to change habits. So even these giant food outfits, they're waiting for us on the other side because they own all these new organic companies also. But I think it is possible to make people not want that stuff anymore.
We've been on a little bit of a simply because I was forced by dint of circumstance to learn about it. We've been on a little bit of a high fructose corn syrup crusade,
mm-hmm.
And that stuff is so insidious. One of our listeners called in and said, you know, Bob, I hate to ruin your lunchtime can of tomato soup, but it's in there too.
Oh, it's in everything, right? Yeah.
That's a
more complex issue because we're hooked on that stuff, aren't we?
Well, now the economy. Yeah, and now they found out that it actually enhances the growth rate of pancreatic cancer cells.
Yeah.
And you find yourself going, you know, Jesus, what do we have to tell you? And so the question, what that leads me into asking, is whether, and we'll sort of limit this to fine dining, since that is, you know, that's the place from which you come. When we go to talk about ingredients, base ingredients that a chef works with, and you go in and you pay some pretty serious coin for a meal, how certain, on average, can the average dining customer be that the base level stuff, the bread that comes to the table first, that kind of thing, has been made on the place?
Never better. Basically, I mean, it is in the history of this of dining in this country, the quality of ingredient that you're getting, the food handling, the skill with which it is made, stored, cooked. It's never been better. I mean, it's been a huge, just in the last 10 years, cooking is a profession with a future now and some glamour and prestige attached. There is a sense now that customers actually know the difference. If you go to any kind of responsible fine dining restaurant now, everything is almost annoyingly sourced. You know, they don't tell you it's a lamb chop. They tell you the name of the farm, the name of the farmer, the state it came from.
The name of the lamb.
Yeah, it's wild. You know, all of it. In any kind of a fancy restaurant.
Does that extend outward from major urban centers like New York, Chicago, L.A.? Is it something that you're seeing in flyover country, so to speak?
Yeah, a lot. We just did we called it a Heartland show, but I mean, it was, you know, filmed in Austin, Des Moines, Columbus, Ohio, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, Denver. I'm seeing that same thing happening everywhere. I think, you know, the last people on board, you know, are the school system, you know, the school systems and the fast food, chains. But to the extent that we can, you know, scare people away from the big chains, if those were replaced by a little, you know, remember the mom and pop, you know, the little mom and pop restaurant, three or four things on the menu, you know, that's good. That's a good economy.
What kind of the recent disaster in the Gulf and what it's done to the seafood and the shrimping and the industry? How long does it take for that to ripple out into the the restaurant world and what kind of, with that particular disaster, what kind of ripple effect do you expect?
Well, I mean, there's two effects. One is the, you know, I think you're already immediately, you saw a huge drop in the market just because people, the perception was that the stuff might not be good. You know, there's a oil spill in the general neighborhood. I don't want to eat anything from the general neighborhood is a decision I'm sure a lot of people made. So the shrimpers and oystermen and fishermen down there, I'm sure, took a huge hit before, you know, the first fleck of oil was found on any fish. As far as the actual effect on the food supply, we're probably going to be looking at that closely for many, many, many years. I know that the industries themselves have been spending an awful lot of money, doing an awful lot of testing. I mean, it is in their interest to prove beyond a doubt that the supply is good. But as far as the long-term effects on the environment, on the places that this seafood comes from or spawns or whatever, we don't know. I guess. I mean, I'm hoping it's minimal. I mean, I'm rooting for these guys. I would rather, frankly, eat, you know, I'd rather take a slight chance on my food supply than see, you know, and that you know, those industries collapse.
Well, you've got that wonderful chapter in Medium Raw about standing and observing the man at was it Bernardin?
Yeah.
Working. I mean, he sounded like an artiste and not not a guy who chops up fish. And
yeah, we have to be. I mean, it's the finest seafood in the restaurant in the country, and you know, every single portion he's cutting has to be absolutely perfect. As he said, every piece, it's my chef's face and his name.
And as I read that, and this disaster was unfolding in the Gulf, I thought, you know, the outfit that has a piece of fried cod next to the steak, next to the ribs, next to the whatever, they won't feel it so badly. But a place like Bernardin, or God knows various and sundry Japanese restaurants, sushi, sashimi, they're gonna feel it profoundly. And I sincerely hope for the good of the country that we get well from it, simply because, as you have noted on a number of occasions, both of those, and increasing, you know, just increasing the fish diet as opposed to eating poor Bessie, who, you know, died up to her knees in...
I'm concerned, honestly, first and foremost, I mean, just as a former chef, as a restaurant guy, my first thought was of the whole food culture. I mean, New Orleans is a hospitality restaurant food culture. You know, New Orleans has traditionally been all about music and food. And, you know, when you're altering something in that equation, when you're in any way implying that there might be, you know, something, you know, less good now about you know, New Orleans seafood, which is so integral to its cuisine, that was terrifying to me. So that's something I think, you know, everybody should do absolutely everything they can to keep that culture alive, that culture of fishing, that culture of cooking, that culture of just having a good time. I mean, there is no more American city, uniquely American city. You know, there are a lot of cities that are, you agree, a lot of great American cities that are, they look kind of like someplace else. There's no place that looks or feels or smells or tastes like New Orleans. And, you know, we didn't get it right the first time, things went bad down there. I really hope we can get it, we can do better this time.
And have you, just out of curiosity, have you been back to New Orleans since the No Reservations episode shortly after Katrina?
Yes. Yeah.
Is anything getting any better?
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, it's the people who chose to stay there, you know, they're just not going to, you know, they're not going to change. They're not going to be happy living any place else. New Orleans will always, always, always be a great city. But it's not like everything's better. You know, we as a nation should not be patting ourselves on the back saying, well, everything's fine down there now. It's not, you know. I mean, we lost a lot that we don't seem to be getting back. You know, the whole makeup of the city changed, and I think we don't know yet how much more it's going to change. You know, are we going to see some yuppification of New Orleans? Is it I don't know. I know that you know, the people who chose to stay and open restaurants and fight the good fight and you know, they're heroes to me. You know, it's really one of the great American cities, one of the great cities in the world.
And just to wrap up and put a bow on all of this, Anthony, Medium Raw makes clear that, and you do it with a wonderful tongue in cheek, that you took a fairly dim view of television. How hard would it be, and you also chronicle the changes in the industry just since you've been in it, how hard would it be for you to start or pitch a No Reservations now as opposed to when you got going?
Wow, that's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of people would like the sound of it, but then when push came to shove, you know, yeah, we want something really, you know, dark, edgy, and kind of, you know, a lot of people have done those shows, you know, but they don't really want it. They get scared at the end. Like, we want it edgy, but not too edgy. I think I lucked into a good thing. I think from week to week, we just made sure on the show that, you know, television likes to repeat whatever worked last week. So we've worked really hard to whatever it was they think they liked last week, we try to do something else next week. So in that way, we present the moving target. We try to keep the network in a state of confusion, if not terror. And at the end of the day, you know, the numbers have been good for them. It's been a good experience for the network. Obviously, it's been good for us, and we found ourselves in this really weird, unique spot on the wave where we can do whatever the hell we want, and they let us. So, I don't think anyone...
Has anyone ever told you no? I mean, have you ever suggested, you know, I want to go to North Korea? No, not this year.
In the history of television, I'm serious, I don't think anyone has ever had as much creative freedom as I've had on this show. They've asked us to beep a few things for, you know, language issues that I was hardly surprised by. On the other hand, they've let so many things through that, you know, even we were shocked. No, I have no complaint. Tonight's show is entirely in black and white letterbox, and much of it is dubbed. Who gets to do that?
And I was going to ask you, as we sort of head out, talk a little bit real quick, please, about tonight's episode, because as soon as I sign off, I'll be running to the television and, you know, getting the popcorn going and everything. This was your first trip to Rome?
First trip to Rome. I grew up on, you know, Italian, early 60s Italian films. I thought they were beautiful. But this show comes out of the fact that I work with some of the best camera people in the business. I mean, incredibly creative, talented guys and a great editors. And they told me right after winning their Emmys last year, we were all getting drunk, and they were boasting that they could make good, high-quality food porn in black and white. And I said, oh, yeah, you think so? Well, let's go to Italy and shoot an entire hour in Rome in black and white, sort of an homage to early 60s, you know, Fellini films. But let's make the best show we possibly can, but let's also make it incredibly gorgeous. And let's do something that's never been done in the history of food or travel television, just because we can.
Well, one last question. Will there be a next season and a next season after that?
Yep. We start shooting as soon as I'll be wrapping up post-production on this season, and a few weeks after that in the fall, starting up on season 7.
Well, best of luck, and thank you again for taking time to talk with us this evening. Your show has a way of coming into conversation on any given night. Generally, there's a Tony Bourdain reference and there's a Star Trek reference. We can count on those two things.
Thank you. It should be a fun one tonight.
All right. I'm looking forward to it, and best of luck with the book, and can't wait till the next one of those either.
Thank you.
Tony Bourdain, thank you very much, and have a great evening.
Good to be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Oh, that's cool. Tony Bourdain, author of Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, from Echo Press, an imprint of HarperCollins. I think you get an idea for why I actually do take time to... I take time to watch the show. There really aren't. I mean, you'll know if you've spent any time at all with this program that I don't watch a lot of TV. Yeah, you can find me on Saturdays in front of a college football game with my beloved Mountaineers, Mountaineer basketball, the occasional something worthwhile on PBS. And I'm not a TV snob. It's just that What's there? Well, lucky for me, at 10 o'clock on Monday nights, No Reservations is there with Anthony Bourdain. And the book, one of the things that I set out to do, I didn't want to give the book away. I don't mean give it away as in here, you know, be the third caller and I'll give you one. No, I didn't want to give away too much of what's inside the book because it is such a joyous read. It is such a wonderful romp. And there's thought-provoking stuff in there. This is not Rachel Ray's everyday living. This is the real deal. So there we go. It's about 25 minutes before the hour. It's Monday on the horn. We'll take a little break and be back. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to the horn. You know the number, 877. Oh, there we go. The numeral 4, head on. Or on your nickel, 304-658-3333. We'll be back. Oh, that seems fitting. The Doors and Soul Kitchen about 20 minutes before the hour. So what are we going to do for the next 2 hours and 20 minutes? I don't know. Oh, yes, I do. Yeah, I do. I know full well what we're going to do for the next 2 hours and 20 minutes because it's Monday, and you know what happens on Mondays? Well, yeah, more and Monday. We got lots of more ands to play with. Things that I'd like to really, really run away from, but can't. as usual. But it's not going to be quite as miserable as that slog into the swamp that we had last Thursday. Our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne from OsborneInc.com, OsborneInc.com, sent me a little Google map just before showtime. And one of the, it's gotta be frustrating to be a New Yorker and watch all this, be a New Yorker and be a normal person and be a humane person and a decent person and watch all this, this god-awful mountain out of a molehill, this miserable tempest in a teapot over the, what are they calling it now? The right wing has gone all the way down the sewer. It is now the 9/11 mosque. I saw a photo today, I forget where it came from, but it showed the actual building where this facility is slated to be built that they don't have the money to build yet. It's the biggest non-issue that we have lately seen. But, you know, it's an old Burlington coat factory outlet between another nondescript building and another nondescript building in Lower Manhattan. On the other hand, the author of this piece also said, but what the right wing thinks it is. And it showed this, this giant Taj Mahal-like, mosque-looking thing with minarets all over creation, a statue of Osama bin Laden as tall as the Statue of Liberty, and a sign that said 2,976 down, 300 million to go. Sheesh. And, you know, maybe we talk a little bit about Barack Obama's response to that. I'm not so... But you know how I feel about organized religion. Your business, what you want to do with it, what you want to do with your time is your own. Please leave your faith out of my life. You know, easy enough. But most religionists are not willing to do that, especially not the Christian fundamentalists. The easiest solution to it all would be to bulldoze every church, every house of worship within. I don't know, 100 miles of ground zero if we're gonna make it a holy shrine in and of itself. No religions anywhere near it. Sorry, no Episcopals, no Catholics, no Jews, no Muslims, no Presbyterians, no Lutherans, no Jains, no Wiccans, no Animists, no nothing. That ain't gonna happen. But anyway, there's gonna be a Muslim YMCA. That you can't even see ground zero from it or nothing, but it's an affront, and it don't take into account the sensitivities of the people in New York City. And this, of course, is being said by some horse's ass from Texas who wouldn't know the Bronx from the Bowery, nor I, but I don't profess to. And so Matt Osborne sends me along this little Google map. Yes, it's true. There are 7 Japanese restaurants almost within sight of Pearl Harbor. Some of them are actually within sight of Pearl Harbor. That's right. You can sit in a Japanese restaurant and look out on Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. I think that's terribly insensitive, don't you? To those who lost loved ones on December the 7th, 1941? Oh, for pity's sake. But that's where we are. Email coming in from Ron in Raleigh. You know, little places really do matter to us. Ron in Raleigh writing, you know, I cried when they closed the last Popeyes here in Raleigh. They don't have Popeyes in Raleigh? That's awful. I mean, we don't have Popeyes in West Virginia. Last time I had Popeyes was found one in Vegas. And in a desperate attempt not to pay $28 for the buffet at the fabulous Rio All Suites Hotel and Casino, whose doorways I will never darken again, we got some Popeyes. And it was yummy. But it wasn't like having Popeyes in a place like Alabama or Louisiana. No, Ron says, I cried when they closed the last Popeyes here in Raleigh. To add insult to injury, they converted the building into a gun store. Oy. but that's how it goes. By the way, thanks to all of you who are sending your good wishes along for Agnes. Let me do a quick schedule update. We don't know. She went for blood work today. You know, you have to do that before surgery. And so now they're telling her, gee, we don't know if it's going to be Wednesday or a week from Wednesday. So, you know, we'll find out. But at any rate, the schedule being what the schedule is, don't expect shows either Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. We'll run some kind of rerun. Tosh suggesting earlier today that I run a really, really old show. Well, I can do that. I can do that. Now, do we just dive straight into the morans, or do we go for the heavy stuff? I got to tell you, I'm all burned out. I really am. Apart from what I just said, I'm all burned out on the fact that some Muslim folks want to build a semi-ecumenical center that's going to have exercise equipment, a gym, and maybe some, I don't know, maybe the handball court. I'm all burned out on it. The people opposing it are godforsaken idiots. And what more really is there to say about that? Me, not so much. But we do have morans. Oh, sweet Jesus, we've got morans. You know, I'm getting to the point where I think maybe we're going to have to retire Steve King's moran, you know, Iowa, the guy who said, you know, life would just be better if him gays would be quiet about being all that gayness. Hey. No, he's on the list. Yeah. But by far and away, not the onlyest one. It goes on and on. I swear we're going to... No, I'm not going to... No. Questions of the... okay. One last moran relating to that topic. Because this is just too good. This is too over the top. This is too under the moran tent flap. Because it's a CNN contributor. This guy's on the payroll to say this kind of stuff. CNN pays him. Eric Erickson, he of, what was it, Red State, Redneck State, something like that, tweeted, paging the Church of Satan, our founding principles demand Barack Obama support your rights to human sacrifice, carry on. Paging Islamo-fascists, our founding principles demand Barack Obama support jihad. That's why you can't have a meaningful debate or dialogue with these people. Because there you are all sober with your facts all lined up, and you got your little notepad, and you got your little pen, and you've made your points, and you want to make this one first, and... No, we're going to bring that one up and make it second. I don't want to make this one at all, okay? Okay, that was the fourth, but now it's the third. And you're all ready to go. And the other side says, well, it's the Church of Satan. Facepalm. And then to make it worse, because it's a political year, Jesus, sometimes I hate politics for all that we talk about them here. Out in Nevada, Harry Reid is involved in a fierce campaign that ought to be like shooting fish in a barrel. Another food reference. Running against Sharon Angle ought to be easy, because all you have to do is sit around and be quiet. Let Sharon Angle talk, and let what you would hope to be normal, decent human beings in Nevada go, ha! And run away from her. Well, apparently there aren't that many decent, normal human beings in Nevada, or not enough of them. Or Harry Reid is even more craven, cowardly, and lily-livered than we imagined. You know, of course, Friday night at the iftar meal that was hosted by the White House, that the for-profit media dutifully explained to us it was a tradition that had gone back to Thomas Jefferson, who hosted one for some ambassador from somewhere during his presidency. Okay, sure. You know, Jefferson was like that. He didn't want anything to do with anybody's religion, but, you know, if somebody had some, what did he say? Oh, yeah, it neither breaks my leg nor picks my pocket. Mm-hmm. So he hosted an iftar breaking of the fast. And the for-profit media was prompt to remind us that, yes, yes, even our heroic dim leader, George W. Bush, had hosted iftar feast. And they had to say all of that because, well, Barack Obama was hosting one. And if you don't say that in advance, and even if you do about 90% of the time, even if you do, the wingnuts from World Nut Daily or Red State or Newsmuck or any of those other filthy right-wing outfits will be running around, you know, doing their little early proto-primate dance and hollering about birth certificates, Kenya, and Muslims. Right? Enter Harry Reid. According to, well, it's not just Harry Reid. According to the Miami Herald, Senate candidate Jeff Green said, "Common sense and respect for those who lost their lives and loved ones gives sensible reason to build a mosque someplace else." Democratic gubernatorial candidate Alex Sink said 9/11 families, quote, "are opposed to this project, and I share their view." And then comes Harry Reid. According to a report by Greg Sargent over at the Washington Post, this is the pull quote, "The First Amendment protects freedom of religion. Senator Reid respects but thinks that the mosque should be built someplace else. If the Republicans are being sincere, they would help us pass this long overdue bill to help the first responders whose health and livelihoods have been devastated because of their bravery on 9/11, rather than continuing to block this much-needed legislation." And that, Harry, that's why a whole bunch of us liberals and progressives and decent human beings find it so hard to get behind you, Harry, because you cave in. Well, you don't even cave in. He doesn't even cave in. There's nothing there to cave. He's Gertrude Stein's Oakland, California. There's no there. Or is it Kabuki Theater? Is this a water testing thing to see how many people will support Harry versus how many people will support the statement of Barack Obama? You know, someday, and I said this on my Facebook page, someday, it'll never happen in my lifetime, I know it. Someday I'd like to live in a country where the President of the United States doesn't have to constantly spend all his time pandering to various religious groups. I fully support the right of whomever wants to raise the money to build Cordoba House. Absolutely, I do. To not do so is to basically spit on all the principles that have supposedly innervated, energized, and driven this country philosophically through its history. So I'm fully supporting of that. But as someone who doesn't hold any brief for any organized religion, I just wish the president could be left alone to go about being the business, about the business of being the president, and not have to be tormented to make sure that he comes out and says the appropriate words about the appropriate religion. Someday I'd like for the president to be able to walk out and say, "That's a religion." They'll sort it out. But not in 2010, and not in the United States, and not in a political climate where even though a given political party has the majority in both houses of Congress and the presidency, they still find their agenda being driven by a noisy-ass, dirt-dumb, right-wing contingent of freaks. Thanks, Harry. Thanks a million. To the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Bob? Gary.
Hey, Gary, what's up?
Not much. Can you play an old show of Agnes?
I wouldn't begin to know where to find one.
Didn't she do one? I remember her.
Oh, she did. I just don't know what it was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember. I remember thinking, oh, man, it was a really great show. I was thinking she should host this, you know, have her own show. And so if you ever could find it, maybe on the White Rose Society or wherever, you know, that, you know, whenever date that is, if you can find that, I would say replay that. I think, you know, I was thinking maybe you, instead of you trying to get onto some of the places that you were mentioning last week, maybe you can get her on The View.
Oh, she'd be hell on The View.
And from what I gather from Guy James, she's must be somewhat visually interesting, so as he's always huffing and puffing about her. keep an eye on that guy. But anyway, I want to set off a firestorm with you guys.
Okay.
Start the show off. I know a lot of people, what I'm about to say, are not going to agree with me, and mainly you. but I kind of agree with some of the stuff that Robert Gibbs said last week, in somewhat of a more abstract sense. And I've been kind of holding my tongue on it because I listen to, you know, radio and different programs and stuff. And I really do think that mainly a lot of people on the professional left, I don't call them professional left, I don't think they're the professional left, technically. But I really think that it's gone too far in the extreme at this point. I mean, and I think that at some point, some people on the left, extreme left or whatever you want to call it, needs to really look at the real political situation that we really are in and ask themselves, are they helping the process or hurting it? Now, that being said, I know you kind of made, you know, some concessions last week that you would like to see some certain things done, but you realize that we have to proceed in a certain manner.
Well, my only concern, Gary, is that this notion of a professional left, I mean, there is a professional left. You know, it's your Noam Chomsky's and a few other folks like that. But it's not like the Obama administration's been paying attention to them anyway.
No. Okay, we disagree on that. Number one, there's no professional left. If there's a professional left, you would have a talk show like Rush Limbaugh.
I mean, there's
people on the left that have who pays for our media. That's what I'm talking. When I say professional left, to me, that's the professional left. Not, you know.
But the point I'm trying to make, Gary, is that anything that is defined as left in this country is actually dead center. And that's what a lot of us want to do with Barack Obama. We want to bring him back from way the hell over on the right back into the center. Because he's caved and he's capitulated and he's negotiated with and bipartisanized with the right wing so much, while the people like me, well, and I don't mean me, but you know, oh, public option, forget it. Employee Free Choice Act, sorry. Ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, not yet.
But are you talking? So you're talking about the center of consciously. Most people are somewhat where you are in terms of consciousness, in terms of the left. I agree with you. Even what's going to move this country forward is more left policies. But I'm telling you that, you know, from my point of view and from people I know, people who I see, you would probably consider very conservative Democrats. The Harold Ford types, there's just way more of them in our party than people want to, you know, acknowledge. I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I think sometimes people on the left really think they're in the center, and I really don't think you are. I think we're way over to the left. I consider myself to the left.
Well, I mean,
there's not acknowledgement of that.
Then, Gary, let me ask you, what is it that you think you, I mean, not yet. Mm-hmm. What is it that you want that you consider to be way over to the left?
I want a universal health care for all, single payer, and I think we will have that within 30, 40 years.
And but see, if you apply that to any real scale as compared with other countries, that's the normal status quo for most of the rest of the industrialized world. That's not some, you know, that's not some sort of, you know, carrying red banners through the streets whistling the international kind of thing. I mean, it's just painfully normal. It's downright center.
But look at Canadian system. I mean, you're dealing with a far less amount of people broken up into, you know, provinces and I don't want to say balkanization, but they're broken up a little bit more. You know, what we have to do in this system, and you know, and Obama, you mentioned this, and this again where left people say, well, Obama was for single health care, payer health care. He never said he was for it. He said in that speech, he said, and again, he said this, he said that if he was starting from scratch, that is what he would do. But you constantly hear people on the left say, oh, yeah, he was for this from the beginning, and he never was for it from the beginning. I mean, I was, so I disagree with him on that point of view. But I do kind of agree with him to some degree that I...
But he didn't use that starting from scratch language when he was standing up hollering for it in the Illinois State House.
Well, of course. That's part of the evolution of the reality that you come into when you see the mire that we're stuck in right now. But it's a process to get us there. I mean, you know, you start to reform. I can tell you personally, just from my own health care that I was getting, there definitely has been changes made by my health care company. That's actually better for me now. Particularly, you know, Maryland's a little different because they're a little bit more active in the reform, but I've already seen some benefits from it. So if people come to me and say, well, he hasn't done anything and I don't really care for a healthcare bill, well, I can tell you I've cut in, you know, a less amount of money than I was in the past within the last year. And during Bush's whole tenure, it went up almost every quarter. And only now am I finally starting to get some relief. So something happened. And I think the people on the left would just go off and say, well, you know, he gave him the public option. Well, okay, he did, but it is helping some of the stuff that what he's done. And to be honest, you go back and look at what Lawrence O'Donnell said, who was a person who was in the Clinton White House during the time, you know, as a budget analyst, I forgot the exact title. But he said that Obama did probably the best thing that he could do because he just got it through and no one else been able to get it through. And he said he believes they did anything different, they wouldn't have passed it. The reason why we don't have a public option is because of Joe Lieberman and maybe one other senator. Not because of Barack Obama.
No, I think it's, you know, it's your Max Baucuses.
I mean, we keep forgetting.
It's your Mary.
Enemies in the White House.
Yeah, it's your Blanche Lincolns. Your no.
Exactly.
But that comes home to roost with Barack Obama, too, because a president is supposed to be able to drive his own agenda. And if he had actually wanted one, he might have, you know, he might have called Blanche Lincoln or Max Baucus in and said, this is what I want. Don't bring me anything but. But he wasn't, for whatever reason, and I will not ascribe a reason, Gary, for whatever reason, he would not do that.
We don't know if he did it. I don't know. Do you know it? I don't know what he did. I really don't. I don't know if he did it. I'm not saying he did or he didn't, but I do know that in the reality of the situation, I hear people always say, well, you know, FDR had a different Congress. They had more votes. Yeah, it was like 64 or something like that. It's a whole different time and situation. You know, people, you know, had gone through a long, long depression. I mean, you know, so people were a little bit more adamant to doing your strong change. Another thing is that Barack Obama's black, okay? It's going to be very hard to get a Joe Wilson to agree with you. It might be a little easy for somebody like a LBJ, a Texas Southern white man, to twist a few arms to some white senators. I mean, there's a lot of differences here to critique. But we have to admit, this political environment with YouTube and the 24-hour news cycle, is you can't make a comparison now. This is a whole new animal, you know. I hear people say, oh, well, you know, Bush got everything he wanted to do. Bush didn't get everything he wanted to do. Bush tried to push that, the Social Security? What happened? They told him to go to hell. You know, people in his own party. And I hear people in the left say, oh, Bush was there to push everything. I mean, that's the type of talk.
But he wasn't afraid to shove it, though, Gary.
He wasn't afraid to shove it because Bush is an idiot. Just like he wasn't realistic about anything. Barack Obama is somewhat realistic. I mean, I'm not saying he couldn't push harder, and I'm not saying he shouldn't be criticized, but I'm saying it's going over the top, some of the criticisms. I mean, it's hard for me, when I hear a talk show host, not you, say that Barack Obama, George Bush are the same. You lost me, man. Because...
You won't catch me saying that, Gary, because Barack Obama is not an idiot.
No.
He's not. But he also, there's no getting around the fact that he surrounded himself with people who despised what a lot of liberals and progressives actively worked for. We know Robert Gibbs, for instance, was a serious Dean despiser. Well, come on in. You got a job. Rahm Emanuel despised Howard Dean and the 50-state strategy that actually won the presidency for Barack Obama.
Yep. I agree with you. I'm a big Howard Dean fan. If I could switch presidents, I would switch it to Howard Dean in a minute because I think he had it right in terms of what, I've met him and I've somewhat worked for him in some degree. He's the reason why I actually got more interested in politics back when he ran his campaign. I mean, and then, and I wasn't even the first, a Barack Obama person. I came out after I saw his speech and I realized that Hillary was not the person that we needed right now. But my point being is that in the end, he is what we have. And what the left, I think, is doing is really destructive right now. I think we cannot allow the Republicans to get back in office. I don't care. The Democrats don't push everything through perfectly. If we don't get public option, okay, fine, I'll bite my teeth. But the one thing I cannot accept is Republicans getting back in power. I mean, that would be the worst thing. And I think the people on the left are just going crazy. I mean, the far left, or professional left, whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's getting out of control, Bob. I'm sorry. I mean, every show now is a 24-hour battle. I'm sounding extreme now, but it seems like it's just a bashing on Obama. I mean, this whole thing about the Moss, he's flip-flopping, whatever. That's not the issue right now. This Moss is not the issue. People don't have jobs, man. We should be talking
about... Well, that's a question. Of all the things to decide to draw a line in the sand over, and I'm not making any puns or anything, why that? Why that, Gary? We couldn't have a line in the sand. He came out and made a very, very strong statement in support of the rights of those folks to build that building.
Maybe it's a religion thing. I don't know.
Right, and that's why.
He came out today and sounded like he backtracked and said, "Look, I think that this, he said he just based it on what he believes our Constitution and forefathers, are holding up." And he said that's what he draws a line in the sand with.
And frankly, maybe it would be better for this country if we did establish some sort of everybody has to accept everybody else's biases standard for whether a religious institution can exist. Because if that's the case, I'm getting a bulldozer. Because every time there's a couple of churches around here, every time I drive by them, I mean, I just feel like I want to vomit.
Maybe we should just have church zones, and this is where all the churches are going to be, and that's going to be it. You just can't put it everywhere, but that's getting passed to some, I don't know if it's a side issue, because it is core to some people in our country, so I guess we shouldn't totally, throw it away, but in the end, we are a government of man, not a government of what you believe as a god or a higher entity. I mean, we're a government of man, and that should trump all religion. I mean, even the Bible, says that. So, I mean, I mean, maybe some of these people should read their own, religion. but I can't.
Right, and that's the question. Are we really going to do that? I thought the right wing... And I'm not really talking about this particular issue of this particular not a mosque, we find the right wing defining how we will talk about our politics in this country, and how we talk about our social structure, Gary. Are we really going to create tests for what is religiously tolerable? Because if that's the case, the First Amendment's done. It's not, I've said a million times, if I've said it once, that the First Amendment, by virtue of the various and sundry rulings of the Supreme Court and so forth, is little more than a life support system for the religion industry. Well, apparently the right wing is not even satisfied with that. They don't even want it to be that.
The reason why it's not even worth talking about is that the Republicans don't believe. It's one thing. If they really believed in religion and really believed in it, then maybe we can have a real fight. But in the end, they don't believe no more than you don't believe in it. Many of them, I mean, or they wouldn't do some of the things they do. They wouldn't be so hypocritical. They really believe that they would follow their teachings. But the point being is that this is what I mean why we don't have a professional left, because they set the agenda on the media and every day. If we had a professional left, radio stations, TV, media, being backed by these so-called professional left people, which there are none, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I hear what you're saying. But until we have a media structure that is paid for, and like Rush Limbaugh and think tanks all around everything, not like just environmental groups, I can't buy that there really is truly a professional left, because all they're doing every day, it's like, for example, Shirley Sherrod situation, that whole racist thing, okay, whatever. They blew that up right when the Democrats were doing something. Now, granted, I don't think their reform was that much of nothing, but it was something they were trying to do. It's just funny that all these things just keep coming up every time the Democrats are starting to...
It's because they're better at it than we are, Gary. I mean, I'm not yelling at you.
They got more money.
No. Here is where I'm going to differ with you.
Okay.
The right wing, and I think this may be at the heart of the Gibbs comments. During the Bush years, those 8 long, miserable, tormented years, if George Bush said that he wanted to make butt scratching obligatory along with saying the Pledge of Allegiance, there was a dedicated cadre of right-wing the journalists, pundits, and most especially the bloviating right-wing blowhards on the radio waves who would have said that every good American needed to scratch his butt while saying the pledge. Okay? And there would have been no question about it. Well, here comes Barack Obama. And he wants some of that. He wants some of that love. He wants somebody who will be out there banging on his agenda without asking questions. He wants somebody who, by God, will march when told to march. But here's the secret, Gary. It's not that they've got more money. It's that the right wing understood media a long time ago and took the trouble to build that machine that would do that job. And so
you don't think they have better money? You don't think that they
Better money was part of it. But at ground level, it was the desire to control the message in that way and to recognize the value of being able to. So Robert Gibbs stands up and he gets all pissy with this group that he made up, the professional left. And what that amounts to is the Obama administration saying, hey, you know, we want somebody to love us like Rush loved George Bush. And my answer to that is, well, you dumbasses, why don't you start talking to some of your big money donors and get them to donate to build the infrastructure that will allow that messaging machine to exist?
Good point. Point taken. But I think that one thing has to be said, that maybe it could have been, again, another one of these master strokes, because even though I think it was, at first I said, well, it's kind of stupid of him to say that, even though I'd agree with some of what he's saying in terms of the sentiment, I think that in the end, maybe it was a better in the end that he did bring it up, because now at least it's open. People like myself and other people now can talk about it, and maybe we can hash some things out, and maybe opens up that conversation, you know, a little bit more. You know, I'm not necessarily a Maureen Dowd fan, but, you know, the article that she wrote recently on the other day, I kind of understand where she's coming from to some degree, but again, I don't agree with her on a lot of things. Nor do I agree with Paul Krugman on a lot of things as well. I mean, I think he has the right ideas, but implementing these things, I mean, you can't say he should have passed a $3 trillion stimulus bill when he can barely got through that one, the 8-point whatever it was through. I mean, come on, you got to be realistic here. I mean, you know, so, and if you're going to criticize him, I mean, look,
I don't reserve my criticism solely for Barack Obama. You know that. I mean, I just got done dropping a rock on Harry Reid.
Yeah.
You know what a sad little man he is.
He's been in Washington too long. It doesn't take long to look how long Obama been there. Give him like another what? He's been there like 5-6 years now.
And yet there you are with Harry Reid. And you I was on the air. I said it behind this microphone, Gary, that I will not sit and shed any tears if Harry Reid loses in November. I said that. I said he should be beaten. And if he had, if he had any other candidate, practically, except for Sue, take a chicken to the Dr. Loudon, or Sharon Angle, then he would be in real trouble. I think he would have been in real trouble if he'd had a viable Democratic opponent in the primary.
Yeah, but I'm not overly concerned about with what happens to Harry either. I'm the same way. But what I'm saying to you is that what we have to do is be better at attacking the peripheral areas around Obama. Take out the Blanche Lincolns. You know, we failed there. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they're like, oh, you know, we should get Miss Hillary Clinton. Oh, really? Well, wasn't it Bill Clinton who went out and put Blanche Lincoln back in office? I think so. So I said, no.
Well, it was Blanche Lincoln and Barack Obama. I mean, it was Barack Obama and Bill Clinton that, yeah.
Yeah, but it was Bill who got over the hump, I guess, you know. But my point being is that with Bill and his situation, I mean, he is that, he ran, you know, we know his presidency. I mean, he was what Tom Hartmar said, the best Republican, Democratic Republican ever. I mean, and there's some truth to that because, I mean, we wouldn't have all these jobs lost to trade if it wasn't for Mr. Clinton. So, and surplus based on, you know, I created the internet, Al Gore, might have helped a little bit to the surplus. So, I'm not saying I didn't think President Clinton was a good president or anything, but I think we got to kind of like stop putting him up there at some super elite status because, you know, a lot of people, I can tell you, are hurting because a lot of decisions he made. They just didn't bear out totally in his presidency, but now we're starting to feel it. So,
well, presidential decisions also often have chickens that come home to roost long after they're out of office. And
yeah, well, he didn't totally reverse Reagan, what Reagan had started. And Obama's going to look like, you know, if he has to be careful not to do the same. I mean, he's still young in his office. I mean, he's just about 2 years now. And I remember I saw an interview with Clinton years ago, and Bill Clinton said, it's a job you never prepared for. He said it takes about 2 years. So after the second year, you start to get a sense of what's going on. And if we were to get rid of some of these get more progressive candidates in and get some of these other people out, then it will send a message to the Obama administration that we want more progressives. But the progressives, I'm telling you, it doesn't seem like we can get people out of office that we don't like. People who, you know, it just seems like, you know, and it's constant bitching and moaning, but in the end, it's not getting the party where it needs to be. You know, I'm all for about getting the party where it needs to be, but it has to be done, to me, in a certain kind of way. I know people don't agree with
me. No, but there are people who are figuring that out, Gary, and the fact that there was a significant primary challenge to somebody like Blanche Lincoln speaks volumes. The fact that this individual, no, I mean, you know, remember, he beat her in the actual primary. You know, not that he was some sort of over-the-top liberal, but Colorado, the real progressive who challenged the Bennett guy, the real progressive, he ran out of time and money. His message was resonating.
Well, I think it is resonating to some degree. I agree with you because you haven't heard too much from Joe Lieberman lately, have you?
No, he's laying. I think Joe's gone to ground for a little while.
Okay, well, that goes to ground for a while. Maybe he doesn't want to bull out his time. I don't know when his next election is. I don't think it's this cycle. I can't remember.
I think he runs in 12.
12. Okay. Six.
And I still think he won't run.
Yeah.
I think he and Hadassah have nice gigs with some pharmaceutical industry or the organization or something like that. He won't run. He doesn't need to.
Well, you know, I don't want to get into one thing, man, just before I go, because I know you got other calls. Tim Tebow scored a touchdown, from what I understand.
No.
Don't tell me it's true. I heard he ran for a touchdown.
Oh.
I heard that they're now calling for him to move up. I was reading on ESPN.
God, who are they playing?
They're calling for him to move up over Brady Quinn now. He should be upgraded based on his play so far.
Well, that's just anti-Catholic bias. Who were they playing? Do you know? Or I mean, what was it? Was it late?
I believe it was Cincinnati.
Was it late in the fourth quarter, and they had the one-legged water boys in playing?
Came in the third and played the rest of the game from then on. But from what I understand, he did run for a touchdown, and I heard that he threw a couple good passes, but the receivers didn't catch them. They dropped them.
Yeah.
But he said he would even been even better. His numbers would have been even better. So I don't know, man. You may be seeing Tim Tebow for a little while.
You know what? I had an email exchange with Tosh earlier today, and he's a big Ravens fan. He's in Maryland like you. And he said, you know, the Ravens play the Broncos in week 5. And you know what? If that's the case, and if the Broncos are like 0-4 going in, then maybe you'll see some Tebow, because maybe those fundies that are watching all of those Focus on the Family ads that have been bought out there, maybe they'll make enough of it to force the coach's hand and make him start him, in which case, for the first time in my life, I will become a big Ray Lewis fan.
No, there's a silver lining in this. Carl Orton, the starting quarterback, looked great and has been looking great in camp and looked great yesterday. So right now, he won't be seeing anything unless Kyle Orton get hurt. So there's your silver lining.
No. See, I want him to get out there and play with the big guys.
Well, he'll be out there. Not playing
against Cincinnati's fourth string. Yeah, that must have felt like one of those Florida games against St. Eustace's for the deaf and blind. You know, one of those.
Somebody's going to send him a message sooner or later. Don't worry, Bob.
Can't happen soon enough to suit me.
I'm too hard on you guys, but just my opinion.
No, I understand, and I'm sitting here watching my email while we're talking, and you're getting a lot of pushback from Ron and Raleigh.
Okay.
He says, by your analysis, you would have accepted something short of the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act, because it would have been too difficult to get pushed or to get passed. And Ron's kind of disgusted, and he says we're going to be half measured to death, and the right and the business interests are going to game the system some more. So,
I'll say to him, Social Security was not perfect when it was passed, and the other bills were not perfect. I mean, there was still provision, even civil rights, they had to rectify and fix. And so we got to understand that, the legislative process is not an end, at once it begins.
And you're getting some pushback on the notion that Al Gore never actually said that he invented the Internet.
No, my point being that was just that he was involved with a lot of the telecoms and industries, and because I used to go to those functions. So he helped facilitate a lot of things that helped grow the Internet. I don't know about what he said, Internet, but I was just making a point that he had a lot more to do in the Clinton administration than I think a lot of people give him credit for.
Oh, and David in Tennessee updating me, he said, Timmy and his god-awful passing motion came in late in the 33-14 loss to the Bengals. He was exciting as a runner and so-so as a pigskin flinger. And David reassures me, saying, don't worry, every team is wishing for their shot at Friar Timmy the Monk.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. Well,
all right.
You get some pushback. It's going to make an interesting show. All right, Bob.
And I'm grateful for that. Thanks, Gary. Take care, my friend.
Take care.
Bye now. Bye-bye. Onward we roll. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, it's Haven.
Hey, Haven, what's up?
I tuned in just in time to hear most of Gary's call, and I'm a little exercised about it. I guess there were several other things that I was thinking about talking about. I haven't spent a while since I called. I have a whole, a whole list of crap.
Well, don't hide your light under a bushel, man.
But look. As far as not letting Republicans back in power, how about somebody tell Obama not to let Republicans back in power? How about somebody tell Obama to stop disrespecting his base? How about somebody tell Obama that stop sabotaging your base? And he makes every couple of months or so, he makes these speeches that the left, the people who supported him and went door to door for him and made phone calls for him and got hung up on for him. And I'm one of those people. We did these things, and he gets up there in speech after speech after speech and runs his mouth about how we need to be realistic and we need to be patient and all this other bullshit. And I'm sick of that. Sick of it. Every time this guy, every couple of months, he makes these dumbass speeches. And, I give him some credit. I understand he hasn't been president that long. But back when he was campaigning, I heard other people say, and I kind of agreed with it. I said, I understand that. he's campaigning, and people say, well, as far as holding his feet to the fire, he's campaigning right now. Let him run his campaign. Let him see what he can do against Hillary Clinton because she's throwing the kitchen sink at him. Okay, fine. I get that. Hold tight. And don't, you know, don't hit the people who support him should not sabotage him in the midst of his campaign. After he won, after he beat Hillary, the idea was, well, don't criticize him now because McCain is going to give, McCain has basically taken up Hillary's strategy of throwing the kitchen sink at him, along with Sarah Palin. So don't, you know, hold tight on the criticism now. But there were certain things, and I think, you know, we remember there were certain things he was saying during the campaign that were out of order, but, or vaguely kind of like, you know, why would he say Ronald Reagan was a transformative figure? I mean, that's, you know, one of these really neutral kind of things you can say where you really don't offend anybody. And this speech on race that he gave, where he kind of, again, he split the difference, and it was an honorable speech, but for some reason, people thought, oh, well, when he was finally elected, you know, there were people on Democracy Now who were hailing him as, and these were notable people, hailing him as the second coming of Martin Luther King Jr. It was not, or the second coming of Malcolm X. And that's ludicrous bullshit like that. And now, well, even after he was elected and inaugurated, people said, well, don't criticize him. Let him do something. Let him, you know, give him some time. Give him maybe a year to get his feet set. And then we can determine what direction we want to push him in. We can kind of push him in a more liberal direction. Okay. With the criticism and whatnot. And now here we are, 2010, August, and people still are like, well, wait a minute, it's the midterms. No, don't criticize him now, it's the midterms. We could lose the House and the Senate and the Supreme Court and all this other bullshit. Look, this guy is not who a lot of people thought he was, and which is not to say that he was deceptive about it.
That's the question. Is he who he said he was?
No, he's not. Well, he is who he said he was. But I think people, what Tom Hartman said, he was this Rorschach test that a lot of people placed their own interpretation on. And that is, I think that's more the bottom line. But, you know, there's the Black Agenda Report, which basically had him pegged from day one. That's blackagendareport.com, which I've looked at.
I read it
regularly. Yeah, and I mean, you really can't, their criticism is thoughtful and is accurate. And that's not to say that Obama can't be, a great president, but it's not like he is unresponsive. He is responsive to pressure from the right.
He's responsive to the wrong people.
Exactly. And we have, and I,
and that's the source of my question about his. And I understood the statement that he made following the Iftar feast or before the Iftar feast about the not a mosque in New York City. I understand that we can't have some sort of public opinion testing for which religion is to be tolerated. You know, it was George Washington Haven who said, we have gone past tolerance and we are into freedom territory. People have to be free, not tolerated, but free. Because, you know, tolerance can be ended at any given time. And we live in a world that has Muslims in it. And we live in a country that has Muslims in it. And Muslims are going to want to do Muslim things. And, you know, we can't sell America short, or the First Amendment, or the freedoms that we guarantee ourselves. Can't do any of that. And I understand every bit of that statement, but the question I ask, Haven, is why that, why there? Is that really the, I mean, because if, again, if we take all of this into account and understand that it is happening inside a media world that the so-called left, you know, people like me, people like you, if it's taking place in a world that, the rational left, if, you know, I just hate that word, not because I hate leftism, but because I hate the notion that there is one, Haven. But if we're going to be rational about things, then we have to understand that the media are going to manage and control and otherwise own every idea that gets pushed out there, and that they too, just as you complained about Barack Obama, they too live in response mode to right-wing talking points. You know, why are we even talking about the teabaggers? Why are the teabaggers relevant? The teabaggers are relevant because the right-wing controlled and dominated media made it relevant. And by the same token, this. I mean, I saw the statement. It made sense to me. I understood it. But, you know, again, the question occurred to me, why that issue? When I guarantee you that the he's a secret Muslim numbers, poll numbers, will go up a good 8 to 15 points as a result of it.
Right.
And frankly, he can't afford that kind of poll number change.
Well, for Barack Obama, that is making going out on a limb like that, and, you know, even addressing that was very daring of him, actually.
Yeah, it was. But sometimes daring is dumb.
Yeah.
You know, you don't walk in and just walk up and slap a guy in a bar who's got a pair of six shooters, one on each hip. You know, that's daring too. It's also stupid. I mean, do I make any sense? I'm not just picking at him.
Right. I don't. And that's the other thing. It is very difficult when with the right wing, you know, sucking up so much of the air on criticism of Obama. It's very difficult to get coherent, thoughtful criticism. And, all of these imaginary controversies, when there's so much that's real, I mean, like his version of No Child Left Behind is extremely vulnerable, is extremely corporate, and it can be criticized from all sorts of angles, and yet there's nothing in the media, certainly no, I mean, I, well, there's no right winger who's going to address that in an honest way. Instead, they'll say, well, he's going to teach our children the Quran. They're going to have to take, you know, the SAT is going to be based on the Quran or some stupidity like that. And yet there's so many legitimate, there's grown-up discussions that we could be having about these issues.
Yeah, and instead of that, we're discussing what, Haven?
Something about a mosque with a...
Not a mosque with some cardio glides and stationary bicycles? And that's a threat to our freedom? And it's insensitive to the victims of 9/11?
With a nanothermite factory in it, I assume?
Basement. Sub-basement.
Okay, right.
Yeah, it's down there where the Burlington Coat Factory seconds went before they were shipped back to the real factory.
Right.
Jesus. No, I know what you're talking about. And you know, as Marty noted a little bit ago, he said, the universe will not exist long enough to see a president of the United States not have to pander to any religion. And I guess that's the truth of it, and that just means, I guess that just goes to show how far away I am from rational. But at one point in time, the American Atheist put out a press release that said, above all, there must be no federal funds go to, because one of the things that was being floated was that, well, you know, if they can't do the Burlington Coat Factory building, then we'll get them some grant funds to help them get another place somewhere else. To which I, who have no problems with this Islamic center, said, oh, hell no. because the minute that, we had eight years of George Bush, and PR funds, your dollars from the federal coffers used to fund snowflake baby PR campaigns to encourage nice white Christians to implant nice white embryos in their nice white wives' white wombs. And I had a belly full of that early on, and I don't want no more. And the last thing I want is for this thing to set a precedent whereby the first snake handlers church and carpet burn rolling society can go and get a couple of $1 million to build a mega church, two blocks down from me. And that, I don't care about the phony. I mean, we can point out that this controversy is phony, that it's ginned up, that it's not even real, that they don't even have the money to build the damn thing. But ultimately, the real disturbance for me, Haven, is the fact what happened in the White House, Haven? Did Barack Obama say, hey, call Gibbs in here. Hey, listen, you really stirred up the hornet's nest. Now I'm going to show them how liberal I can be. Over the not a mosque? And if that's the case, then there's a lot more to worry about in this administration than simply, is he or isn't he? Because at that point, it becomes rather obvious that they're clueless.
Right. Well, they are clueless. His guiding my mantra, as far as I can tell, is don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Or one thing he said was don't let the perfect stand in the way of achievable goals. So he's made it plain that it's not that he does not have a political imagination. He is not in favor of really using that. I think he sees himself as just another president. I think that he believes that he's going to be president for 4, maybe 8 years, and after that he's going to hand it over to somebody else, and time will go on, and he may have his face on the penny he's just going to be eventually just another in a long line of presidents. And I don't think he sees himself as this transformative president. He doesn't see himself as another Ronald Reagan, put it like that. Since he mentioned being transformative, he doesn't see himself in that way.
And yet the thing is, he is proving, well, I'm going to get hell for this. He is proving transformative in a Reagan-esque vein, Haven.
Yes.
Because the middle class that had been reeling from a number of sucker punches over the course of a couple of decades, starting with Reagan, maybe it gets finished off under a Democratic president.
Yes.
The Cat Food Commission is coming in soon. Even a Republican president would not have had the nerve to convene a commission about the future of Social Security and say that we will act on their recommendations. Excuse me. I'm 47 years old. This thing, Social Security is rock solid for every penny that it's due to pay out for the next 27 years. That means I could conceivably, let's see, 54. Yeah, I could actually pull in whatever Social Security I'm supposed to get. That means something. But I won't if the Cat Food Commission has its way, because it wants me to invest. And I ain't got nothing to invest.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a system that I paid into in the past. I can't pay into it now. But I paid into it in the past. I bought my ticket. I took the ride. And the Cat Food Commission doesn't think that's enough? Well, they can kiss my... Well, I'm not going to go there. Sorry. But I understand what you're saying.
It's not a lack of political imagination on his part. It's a refusal of political imagination. I mean, when you say something, man, this, I guess Bill Clinton said this too, don't let the perfect stand in the way. don't let that. I mean, what he's saying is to people who said, well, I think single payer would be a good idea. That's perfection. That is in the way. Move it over there. Get it out of my way. I don't want to deal with that. And I mean, something as basic as something that Martin Luther King marched for the day before he was assassinated, right? Or no?
No, had gone there to march for
the
sanitation workers.
Exactly. Unionization, raising the wages in order to stimulate demand, for goodness sake. And that sort of thing. That's too imaginative for him. And yet there are people running around saying he's the...
Could it be too frightening, Haven? Could it be too frightening?
Too frightening.
Yeah, by the time Martin Luther King went to Memphis, he knew he was walking around a walking dead man. He had already told people. And he'd been, if I recall my history correctly, he'd been saying that for some time.
Yeah, that's true.
That if I am to go, it's clear that he saw a little handwriting on the wall. Didn't want to go, but he said, if I'm gonna, I'm gonna. With that being the case, you know, a guy who has gotten there has become, as they say, dangerous. Because the only thing that will stop him is death itself. If that stops him. You know, but that's a scary place to go to, especially for a young, you know, young 40 something with a couple of little girls.
Okay, but he's got the Secret Service, and I mean, if you're gonna...
Yeah, he's got a Secret Service that named him Renegade. How comfortable would you be at night? Now, I'm not making excuses, Haven. I'm not.
Okay.
But the thing, you know, I can't brook, and I'm not saying that you did, I can't brook any comparison between him and Martin Luther King.
Me neither.
I said once on this show that people only thought that Barack Obama did stunning oratory because they had never heard any.
All right.
Anybody who would compare Barack Obama's speeches to that of Dr. King, that comparison only tells me one thing, that they never heard from start to finish an entire Dr. King speech. Because even if you're listening on one of those crappy old recordings, by the time he's done, you know, the Riverside Church sermon a year before he was murdered, by the time he's done, if you've got a shred of humanity about you, every hair on your body is standing on end, and you're up on the balls of your feet getting ready to go. Even though it was 1967.
Yeah.
And I've never heard one of those from him. And I've listened to most of the major ones, and I even heard one in person. And I got to tell you, the one I heard in person was the most awful speech I've ever heard in my life.
Which one was that?
He spoke to the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Charleston, West Virginia, a couple of years before he ran for president at the invitation of Robert C. Byrd. And it was the most god-awful hurry up. And I mean, the line at the bar, the line at the cash bar there was out the door. It was like people leaving during intermission, and he was the keynote. So, you know, there you go.
Right.
But you bring up a lot of valid points, and I largely don't take issue with them. Let me put it straight, and some people will disagree with me on this. I know. All the way down to the marrow of my bones, Haven, I know what the right wing has in store for us. And to this extent, I can agree with Gary. I know what they've got in store for us, and I don't want them taking the House, and I don't want them taking the Senate, and I damn sure don't want them taking the presidency in 2012. For that reason, understanding the nature of the American political system, he's going back in if it's either going to be him or some knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing freak from the GOP or the teabaggers. And I've still got, you know, I'll lay 3-2 odds that it's Jeb Bush. on a quick, cheap $5 bet. So I know what's coming. I get it. I just want him to, I want him to be better, and maybe that's the problem, Haven. I want him to be better. I want him to be better than he is. It's possible I want him to be better than he is capable of being.
Yes. That is, that may be the issue. I remember I caught a...
And if that's the case, it's my fault.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I caught a section of a speech that he did on, it was a fundraiser, and it was in San Francisco, and he was getting heckled by gay protesters. And he stopped the speech, and he kind of said, you know, okay, you all have issues with don't ask, don't tell. And they said, yeah. And he said, well, I am against don't ask, don't tell. And we're going to fix that. You know, we're going to get, you want to get rid of it, right? And they said, yeah, we want to get rid of it. And he said, well, I agree. So you don't have to shout. You know, why are you getting all exercised about it? Just calm down. We have this under control. Now, this from the guy who said, hold me accountable. This from the guy who said, make me do it. You know, this from the guy who, gave people the impression that he had a political, that he was willing to use his political imagination. But when you actually push him from the left, you get, you know, relax, calm down. If you push him from the right, you get a little more, you get service. you get curbs.
And therein lies the rub.
Except in, you know, there are speeches. He's made quite a few speeches where he's taken the right to task. I'm not, and that's the thing.
Oh, the speech in Baltimore in January?
Right.
Was it Baltimore where he went and said, you know, listen, you people are making yourselves look like idiots. The only problem was they knew that, and it didn't bother them because they know about their base.
Right.
And their base is even dumber than they are. So it was inspiring at the time, but I started scratching my head going, yeah, but the right-wing base is idiots, which presents no small amount of a problem. Haven, I got to roll. It's been a wonderful conversation, but don't be a stranger,
yes,
okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Take care.
Bye now.
All right. This is turning into a Monday night point-counterpoint. That was Haven responding to Gary. Also responding to Gary, Andy, now of California. He says, Mr. Obama promised many, many policies he has reneged on or compromised away. Yes, I'm upset. Yes, Obama did promise a public option. He ran on it. No C-SPAN transparency. Single payer was never considered. Don't ask, don't tell. Defended DOMA. Card check. Giving unions easier ability to organize. Bailed on that. Let telephone companies off the hook with FISA violations. Banned release of additional Iraq Abu Ghraib photographs on tortures. Promised transparency. Did not press mortgage company cram down. Appointed Robert Gates defense secretary, a pure hawk, corporatist feds Ben Bernanke, Treasury's Tim Geithner, and top economic advisor to destroy the middle class, Lawrence Summers. Moved us further away from the public campaign funding. Went with unlimited private funding. Did not replace Bush's state attorney attorneys general, and the Governor Don Siegelman case rolls on. Sided with Israel in Goldstone report and flotilla murders, letting settlements grow in territories. Has not stopped Gitmo or reinstalled rights of habeas corpus. No investigations of torture or Geneva Convention treaty on torture violations. Would not sign landmine treaty. Joe Pisarczyk, head of surface mining, William Lynn Raytheon, Scott of Omalia Morant, Many other corporatists placed in high positions. Bush holdovers in Treasury, James C. Dugan, Goldman people. Kagan, a disappointment for Supreme Court. Obama has not rescinded the Bush tax cuts or inheritance tax. 0% tax this year. Andy says there's more, but Obama's been a major disappointment. I'm for running a challenger against him. We need to keep pushing, and pressing on Obama to change his policies and remove his appointees. Press Secretary Robert Gibbs has got to go. Tell Obama this. I call the White House every day and tell him to remove Gibbs. Thanks, Andy. Mora writing in and says, Bob, as I sit here listening to the show, it strikes me that, in my opinion, Barack's biggest problem is that he lacks passion. He is so Mr. Spock-like that it is scary. And just by way of a little bit of humor, okay, just a little bit of humor, just a sort of, because, this is something called Barack Obama's barbecue. Okay? And it comes from collegehumor.com. But there's something to be said here.
Grilling and chilling. Great barbecue, Barack. I'll have my burger rare.
Ugh, gross. I'll have mine well done.
Relax, friends. I'm sure we can work out some happy medium burger.
Now neither of us are happy.
Barack, my shish kebab fell in the dirt. I know it's ruined.
Here's another shish kebab. Just be more responsible with this one.
Oh, man, it fell in the dirt again. I'm sorry. I thought it was too big to fall.
Well, here's one last shish kebab.
Stop bailing them out!
Man, nothing about this barbecue is going the way I expected.
Well, what's wrong, Trev?
Well, for one thing, there's that grill. I distinctly remember you saying the first thing you're going to do is close that grill.
Look, I know. There's some terrible things going on inside that grill. But I can't find anywhere else to put the meat. Hey, neighbor, you want to take some of this meat?
Not in my backyard.
Turn it open.
Barack, that pork chop is a lost cause. Why are you turning up the heat?
Well, I'm not willing to say that we've lost this pork chop. I'm going to turn up the heat really high for a little while, and then I promise to turn it way, way down.
It does have a lot of oil under it.
Hey, Barack, I'll take two burgers.
Whoa, we can't let burgers get together with other burgers.
We can't?
Lunch is between a burger and a hot dog.
I thought you said you were going to let two burgers share the same plate.
Never said that. But how about two burgers on a napkin?
Napkins don't have the same benefits as paper plates. Barack, a whole shitload of ants just got into the punch bowl.
No worries, I'll handle it.
You're not going to get angry?
Are you hearing this? He's not even a little bit angry about the ants.
It's a complicated situation, all right? It requires a lot of...
A real grill master would get angry.
Fine. I'm angry, but I'm just waiting to find out whose ass to kick.
Whoa, whoa. Oh,
did you guys hear that?
Completely ridiculous.
Wildly inappropriate.
But you just said that...
Hey, how come only three people have potato salad? In Europe, everyone gets potato salad.
I believe that everyone here should be entitled to potato salad.
All right, it's about time.
Wait a minute. Who's paying for that potato salad?
I just thought we could all chip in.
No.
I don't have money for that.
Guys, I think Barack is throwing an excellent barbecue.
Yeah, especially considering how crappy the last couple of barbecues have been.
For some reason, I just thought that this was going to be an incredible, magical barbecue. You know, it was going to change all of our lives.
Well, that just seems a little unreasonable.
Guys, there's been a terrible oil spill.
An oil and vinegar spill?
What? No, actual oil, crude oil in the ocean. We have to do something about it. I can't believe you guys are just sitting around having a barbecue. There is a legit oil spill happening in the ocean right now.
This potato salad is f***ing delicious.
Ain't it? Just ain't it? Yeah. Just, you know, a little something there. All right, let's keep going on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Great interview with Anthony Bourdain.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, I'm calling about...
What a good guy, you know? So just seems like a good guy.
Yeah. He seems to be a very reasonable person.
Did you hear his little daughter in the background? That was kind of cool.
Actually, no, I didn't. I do like the new... Is that going to be the new opening? Or?
No, that was just for fun.
Oh, okay.
He's a Talking Heads fan.
Oh, I see. That's cool. Well, I'm calling in regards to what Gary said about dialing down the left. Where is that dial, Bob? Cause
where's that
I
left?
To find it.
Where's that left?
Yeah, that's what I mean. I mean, there's nothing to dial down, Gary. I mean, think about this for a second. What are we supposed to say that's going to magically make someone's emotions go away? This isn't Harry Potter.
Oh, score.
This isn't Harry Potter. I can't. I mean, what we have to deal with is the reality that people, and it's really funny to me, the fact that I know where this is coming from, Bob, and you know where this is coming from. This is coming from, this is coming directly from the right wing who can push any kind of directive line and say, well, you know, the left is getting angry. And then the people on the Democratic side, they'll be like, you know what? The left is getting angry. And then they'll forget all about what's happening in the right-wing world. Hey, why don't you guys tone that down a bit? Can you guys tone that down a bit over here? Can you please tone that down?
Oh, you mean the right-wing button? No, that one goes to 11 and it's stuck there.
Yeah. And that's the problem. I think a lot of people are misunderstanding. Okay, let's say we do. Gary, let's say we do tone down the left. Let's say we just all go away and we don't voice any concern. Do you think you would see a lot more, or what I would see, a lot more Hannity Palin stickers? I saw one today, by the way, on the truck.
No, you didn't.
Yes, I did.
Hannity Palin?
Yeah, those stickers are out there. So Gary, here's the problem. Gary, you need to understand this. The culture branding is happening at a rate that you can't even fathom. It's happening all across the country, and it goes back to what I said about Kevin Smith making that movie called Red State, about how the religious right is rising, and there's going to be a terrible epidemic that happens in the United States, and that's what his next I guess he got the funding for it. That's one of his next movies that he's planning. And here's the problem: a lot of the left, they want to pretend that's not happening. Well, guess what, people? The fact that Barack Obama even said the word mosque, he lost. L-O-S-T. It's over. He lost. When he said mosque, the frame was there, people, because guess what?
They it's not a shit. Mosque.
I know. Exactly. They looped that shit like P. Diddy. Just recycled it all across the land. They just sample it over and over and over again. And then Barack Obama comes out and says it's the same thing with the professor. They just find these sound bites, he comes out and he thinks he can correct himself. The problem is there is no correcting once you put that frame down. It's done.
Right, because they've got that knob dialed up to 11, and they own all the speakers, if we're going to extend the metaphor.
That's right, and that's a problem. So when you say, what would happen if we were to dial down left, the right wing would love that, because then they could literally do, well, they can almost do anything now they want to do. And here's the other thing. By Barack Obama, Gary, talking about the mosques when he should have said Islamic Center, what happens when, not if, but when another attack hits the United States? Maybe it'll hit New York. What happens then? I'll tell you what happens. They run that soundbite that they have of Barack Obama talking about.
Oh, sure, but wait. Let me go back with you for a minute, David.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when an attack doesn't come? Because
they're still
running
it.
No, right. They're still going to run with it because they're waiting for it. No, David, they're praying for it. Okay, they're itching for it. I mean, they've got sexual sweats wanting the next one to come.
You know, Bob, they should be concerned about that pastor who's going to still go forward with burning that Quran on 9/11.
Right, because he's got the sex sweats for a war with Islam too.
Right, and that's the problem. All across this country, the right has literally just started. They believe in the spaghetti theory. You just throw whatever sticks.
Yeah.
Whatever sticks, just keep throwing it over and over and over again. This mosque Islamic Center controversy, whatever they want frame they want to put it in the news. This is sticking, and it's sticking in a way. Let me explain something to Gary so he understands. Gary, why is it the people in Maine care so much about a mosque? You know why, Gary? Because it's code words. It's the images they see. It's the visuals. It's the frames.
It's women in burqas and food that they don't know how to pronounce, and you're gonna have to, they're gonna make me pray to Mecca, and all of this crap that doesn't even exist.
I got a good word for the Horn Archives. It's Jack Bauer porn. That's what it is.
Yes, it is.
And that's the problem. And here's the issue. So if no one talks about this, the rhetoric is just going to get louder and louder. So by you telling us, Gary, by you telling us to dial down the left, in effect, what will happen is you basically see riots. You will see a whole religious right rise faster than ever before. We're trying to slow it down. We're trying to ramp it down. But obviously, when you have people come in and say, hey, you need to tone down things a bit, there is no toning down things. There's none. You can't tone it down.
Wait, are we at that point where it's one of those all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing? Is that what we're talking about?
You know what?
Because everything you're saying, David, plays into arguments that I've been making literally for years. And that is that it is our refusal to participate and engage in various and sundry fora. You know, you could say battlefields. I don't like that kind of imagery. But you know what? When you cede the field to the other side, they win without a fight.
That's right.
And the fact of the matter is, Barack Obama was not called upon to say anything about this Islamic center or whatever we care to call it. You know, if he had to say anything, it should have been in the form of responding to a question. You know, and the answer is that they have rights under the First Amendment to the Constitution, and the people of New York City will handle it properly, and it's done. But David, he brought it up.
Right.
He brought it up. He helped to put it in the spotlight. David in Tennessee reminded me, he says, it's a little bit like LeBron and the decision show about playing in Miami. It's the presentation and not the facts of the matter. And I think the analogy is apt. Everything was about the decision, you know, and the presentation of some sort of remark as opposed to the actual facts on the ground. And the facts on the ground are that Barack Obama, the President of the United States, has no power one way or the other in this. What's the right wing want? Do they want him to declare Islamic centers and little old Muslim men trying not to die of a heart attack 2 years instead of 2 years later? Is that supposed to be declared terrorism under the Patriot Act? They want an executive order from Barack Obama. What? He didn't have a dog in the pulpit. You know, I understand the president's bully pulpit, and I'm the one who said last week that I'd like to see a little bit more bully in the pulpit. But this ain't that. And it's not just because I don't have a particular hang up for religion. My God, if you're going to go out there and draw a line in the sand, draw a line in the sand on unemployment and say that, well, you know, by God, unemployment's here, and if it rises 0.1% more, we're going to institute a national work program like the CCC and the WPA, and then watch the freaks go crazy. But at least the freaks will be going crazy on something that will actually benefit people who are trying to make mortgage payments right now and can't. I mean, does this make any sense?
Yes, it does make sense. And, you know, I would just add to the fact that when we do dial it down, we get things like the rise of the Reagan youth. So dialing down is not an option, Gary. I'm sorry. It's not an option. We've been down that road before, and guess what? We took the sailboat on that one.
I mean, nobody's saying, hey, he sucks.
Yeah, no, I don't. See, here's the thing about it. I don't have a personal problem. And I don't even know Obama, so I can't even comment on him. But I can criticize the administration on the moves that they're making for this country regarding us as a people. I think the problem with a lot of people on Gary's side is somehow they think that if we move in slight little increments, that's going to make a difference for the working people and the little guy. Where the truth is, Gary, it's not, because they're going to rip this out piece by piece as soon as any crazed right-winger faction gets in that is sent in to do the job, to do the dirty work, so to speak. And they will rip it out. And they'll take part of Social Security with them like they're doing now. You want to know why? Because, Gary, we dialed down on the Social Security issue, too. And it's nonstop on the radio, baby. all the way to the finish line of let's get rid of Social Security. Let's get rid of it.
Well, let's back up for just a minute, David. Because you know this whole thing, this whole professional left thing, and to a certain extent, I'm bothered that we're still talking about it, but it has relevance.
Right.
This whole thing, the follow up to it was when Gibbs sort of pusillanimously said, "Well, I'd been watching too much cable news," and ever since I read that, did you see that? Ever since I read that quote from Gibbs, I've been thinking, wait just a damn minute.
Yeah.
I've been watching too much cable news. So I'm not a part of the professional left. Malloy's not a part of the professional left.
Right.
Tom Hartman is not part of the professional left.
Exactly.
That leaves three people because, you know, there's no professional left on Fox. There's no professional left on CNN. No one can say that Joy Behar hasn't been absolutely decent and kind to him. CBS, ABC, and NBC don't have any professional left. There's no talk shows, issue shows, whatever, none of those. That leaves three people. What Robert Gibbs did was he took a collective shot all at one time against Keith Olbermann, Rachel Maddow, and Ed Schultz. Okay, because that's all there is. That's all there are. And what he's saying is three hours of so-called liberal or progressive, I like to say normal, issue-oriented news opinion television, 3 hours of that is too much for liberals to have. Because what it boils down to is the Obama administration wants to control the message.
Right.
And bless their little hearts, no one tries harder than Ed Schultz to toe the line for the Democratic Party. And, you know, without going into any details, you know, there's a reason for it. But no one tries harder than Ed Schultz. And, it, you know, when even he is shoved out into the street by this kind of decision-making and has to push back, you know things are getting ugly. But no one tries harder than Ed. And, you know, when Rachel and Keith push back, they do so gently, they do so respectfully. But even that is not tolerable. Because, again, I go back to what I said earlier. Robert Gibbs and the White House want to have a lockstep media that they never bothered to damned well build.
Hmm. Or the other theory could be, and I think it's probable, that Gibbs watches a lot of Fox.
Oh, I think he watches more Fox than he watches of MSNBC.
I'm betting that he threw away the TV dial.
You know, I watch too much cable news. You know what he's pissed off about? He's pissed off because CNN figured out the accidentally, as it turns out, if you were listening last week. But CNN figured out that the Shirley Sherrod thing was a dummied up fraud job and called the White House that had knee jerk reacted. And thereby, you know, made the White House look bad. You know, but that's the way, you know, that's the way I imagine Robert Gibbs sees it. I'm speculating, of course.
Right.
But, yeah, CNN made the White House look bad because the White House pulled the plug on Shirley Sherrod because they were, I mean, this much is not speculation.
Right.
They were afraid that Glenn Beck was going to get them.
You know, the whole phrase, dial down the left, it reminds me specifically of one thing. Frank Luntz's dial machine. Dial to the right or dial to the left? Up or down? I don't know if you've seen it. He has these groups and he has these lines that go up or down, and that's how he's supposed to measure the public's outrage on a political position or political move at the time. And I looked at these machines and I was like, wow. This is almost as worse as the E-meter for Scientology.
Yeah. Oh, and Ron writes in from Raleigh and says, wait a minute, Bob, did you forget about Juan Williams? Isn't he the professional left on Fox? And then Ron says, I'm sorry, I'm laughing so hard I can barely type. But, you know, that's the kind of professional left that Robert Gibbs would like to have.
You know what's crazy? Juan Williams actually fills in for Bill O'Reilly on Fox. That's insane.
I know.
But before I go, I wanted to mention one other thing. We lost a legendary musician today, named Robert Wilson, the bass player for the Gap Band.
Oh, no.
R.I.P. to Robert Wilson. He died at 53 years old. If you know anything about the Gap Band's catalog, they were pretty much a self-made. I hate using that term because it ties into business and economics, but they were pretty much a self-made band from the get-go. They had their own promotion machine behind them, and they built their whole audience basically on a word of mouth. And the Gap Band were a team of brothers, Robert Wilson and Charlie Wilson, and they were both extremely musically inclined. So they had hits like Outstanding, You Dropped the Bomb on Me, Humping
Oh, wow.
And Yearning for Your Love.
Yeah.
So let's all remember Robert Wilson, people, because great musician, great music.
And mighty young.
He gave the best he had.
That's mighty young.
Yeah.
All right, David, take care.
All right, later.
Thanks for some great points. Bye now.
All right, bye.
Let's see. William writing in. He said, I think we were taken. Which does fit into the whole, you know, everyone has one thing. Yeah. I felt Obama would not have been possible if it were not for George W. Bush and all the horror his administration reigned on the country. All Obama had were catchwords like hope and change, and then change we can believe in, and look at how this alone became the main message people wanted to hear. Look at the Democrats in 2006 when they ran on ending the war, yet they lied and funded it to this day. To hell with the troops and the guilt trip in their minds. Look at what choices we had. Look at the turn Edwards took. I've always been a liberal, but man, I have to say now we have two parties that seem to have lost all sight of reality. They develop their own reality, which does not fit with the reality of many people who have lost out at all. If what we're to have is a show and the lesser of two evils, then we have nothing to choose from other than hitting oneself in the head using either a rock or a chunk of wood. And that is no choice. Ron adding, possibly worst of all the things out of the Obama administration, the president has taken upon himself the right to hunt down and assassinate American citizens anywhere in the world. Oh, yeah, were we going to forget about that? Gosh, I hope we don't. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
How are you tonight?
Pretty good. Jim, how about you?
Okay, listen, I enjoyed very much your interview with Anthony Bourdain.
Well, thank you.
And it was a good conversation. I watch his program from time to time, not as religiously as you do, but he does really present a very interesting spectrum as far as cooking and things like that and food.
Well, tonight should be a lot of fun. Like he said, it's all shot in letterbox and black and white. And
right.
it's an homage to Fellini.
Right, exactly. I thought about Satyricon and the other things that came out of Italy not to mention Pasolini and, who did the Satyricon? Fellini and Italian filmmakers have contributed so much to the mainstream of world cinema, in my opinion.
Well, it'll be coming around at 10 o'clock, and I'll be on it like a duck on a June bug.
Well, I'm sure you will. But, you know, going back to the current administration, number one, when they threw Sherry Sherrod under the bus, they really screwed up badly.
Yeah.
I mean, put
both feet in.
When they were pursuing that woman like jackals after a prey and made her pull over to the side of the road to resign on her BlackBerry, what in the hell were they thinking of?
They were just trying to get it done before Glenn Beck could get them. You know, we were cataloging some of this stuff the other night, Jim, and we forget about that. They let Glenn Beck run Van Jones out of the administration too. You know, ultimately they want the dark-skinned man out of the Oval Office, but until such time as that happens, they're happy to try to run out anybody of dark skin that happens to be working there. You'll notice they haven't gone after Rahm Emanuel or Robert Gibbs or Robert Gates or any of the other white folks.
Well, who knows? They're probably saving them for later on between now and November. And, well, as far as the president is concerned, I voted for him. And I realize that he is not the most dispassionate person in the world. One thing he did say about this, about Social Security now and Social Security forever. And he did make a positive statement about that. And as far as this Islamic Center or mosque or whatever you want to call it, because all I've heard over the news media, it is referred to as a mosque, which is fine, whatever. I don't care. I mean, Bob, if they want to build Hagia Sophia or a replica thereof somewhere in one of the five boroughs, it's fine with me.
Yeah, I got no beef with it.
And the president said, number one, he defended religious freedom of all types. But he said, I cannot comment on the wisdom of the present location of where they intend to build this thing in the old Burlington Coat Factory. Or whatever it was. Now, I walked by those buildings many a time when I would go to the World Trade Center when I was in New York. And I would hate to see them use something like this against us in the elections in November. I mean, let me just present this to you in conversation, okay?
Sure.
They could put it somewhere else. I mean, if they went out to Queens in Flushing, it'd be a lot cheaper and probably a lot easier for them to raise the money to build whatever they want to build. But not necessarily within two blocks of Ground Zero. But, I mean, this has become another bêtise of Glenn Beck and all the right-wing people to use against any form of positive change to help people and to hurt Democrats in November. That's what they're doing. And that's the reason the president said that he could not comment on the wisdom of where they would locate this structure. But like I say, personally, if they want to build a replica of Hagia Sophia, it is of no problem to me. Do it.
Right, but the right wing is all about property rights, Jim. I mean, you can't talk to them and say, well, you know, property rights are the central tenet of the Constitution, the right to own property, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I know that, but I mean,
apparently the right to own property doesn't extend to people wanting to build an Islamic center called Cordoba House.
Well, the thing about it is, now, I don't know what type of credence you place in the New York Post, but that's a pretty big paper in New York City. And I know a lot of people in New York have, like I say, I have spent a lot of time there. Now, 52% of the poll taken by the New York Post is against that particular structure being placed where they want to place it. Now, when you look in terms of percentage points and stuff like that, I'm sure the people in the White House are saying, well, we don't want this thing to cause us to lose votes in New York City. Normally, a Democratic stronghold. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So why then say anything about it unless it's a matter of responding to a question at a press conference?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Well, why was it, you know, if they don't want to lose votes over it, why say anything about it?
Well, they don't have to because it's being said by everybody else. And so I guess.
Right, that's what I'm asking about Friday night. Why was it necessary? Because he wasn't asked a question about it and responded to it. He took it upon himself to address, you know, in saying, you know, everybody's got religious freedom, blah, 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 blah. And so now, you know, like I said, the poll numbers are going to go up on the he's a Muslim question. And moreover, I guess, Jim, one of the things that bugs me most about this is that there is an air of something that I think you and I agree is really a hateful notion about all of this. You, with your profound understanding of history that you carry with you, you comprehend, Jim, how dangerous it is when a people begin acting on conceptions of collective guilt. that you know, it's those people. And I think we've got plenty of potential examples. Well, the fit that's being thrown over Cordoba House is basic, and even for people like Harry Reid to say, well, you know, let them move it. They've got the freedom to build an Islamic center, but not there. They don't have freedom to build it there. They have freedom to build it over there, but not there. Inherent in that statement, as far as I can tell it, is a desire to force Muslims in this country to acknowledge and bear some sort of collective guilt for the actions of September 11th, 2001.
Well, I understand that all too clearly.
And that's repugnant.
Well, like I say, I understand that all too clearly. And it's not the first time that the extreme right wing and Hannity's and the Glenn Beck's and people like that, they enjoy the term repugnant. And I just don't want to play into their hands. I've seen it happen too many times, Bob. I really have. I mean, if, you know, I will say this, Paris is worth a mask. If they can build it a little further away or wherever, that would not bother me at all. I mean, what I don't understand is why has there been this emphasis to take over this old building? Have you ever seen that building up there?
I've seen photographs. It's certainly nothing special.
Oh, God. Listen. That place looks like it's going to fall down.
Maybe that's a good reason to buy it. Maybe it was cheap.
No, I don't think so. That's prime real estate.
I mean, there's no such thing as cheap, but not in you know, lower Manhattan.
No, not at all.
But on a relative scale, maybe.
You know, perhaps, you know, it would be, what I'm trying to say is it could be built elsewhere to cause less controversy, which could hurt us in the fall and further undermine the legitimacy of this man's presidency. Because, as you have very ably pointed out, there have been a number of shortcomings in what I will call his report card and what he has promised to do but has not been able to do. And, you know, historically, we have so many campaigns in which so many presidents are promising this, that, and the other, and when they get into Washington, they get into the White House, and they have to deal with the people inside the Beltway. And let me tell you something. Washington is one of the most unforgiving places in the world. I mean, there's a program.
Unless you're Newt Gingrich.
Well, you know, I don't even know about him, because I think a lot of people really have to hold their nose when he comes around, because I think that man has so discredited himself in so many ways, or at least to thinking people. But the trouble is, there just aren't enough thinking people. And there are too many people to whom these ad hominem comments and ad hominem whatever and whatever things that do not appeal to the spirit of the mind and the sense of fair play, people simply don't want to adhere or to pay attention to those higher elements of our mentality.
Especially when there is an entire segment of society doing its dead-level dogged best to make sure that people pay attention to the lowest levels of their, the baser levels of their humanity. Let me ask you a question, Jim.
Yes, sir.
And this is a messaging issue. And again, I appeal to your knowledge of history, both modern and ancient.
And I thank you for your comments there.
St. Peter's Basilica was built literally, I mean, it's St. Peter's because it's built on the bones of St. Peter, supposedly. Right?
Right.
There are Roman Catholic churches the world over that are where they are because they are said to be somewhere that something literally god-awful happened to some early adherent of the faith. Is that a fair statement?
It is indeed, and let me interject one comment. I think that the Roman Catholic Church wanted to build something near Auschwitz, and then they realized, look, no, and John Paul II said, well, perhaps we better reconsider this, because this is not a Roman Catholic type of situation that Auschwitz represents, and the decision was made not to put the facility there.
But facilities are, and they do exist, and not just in Roman Catholicism, but in other faiths as well. You know, maybe you've got a Hindu temple where one of the multifarious Hindu gods ascended into somewhere or did something. Yeah, I don't know that much about Hinduism. But the point being, what if, on the other hand, the organizers and proponents of this Islamic Center said, we specifically want to build this where we want to build this, not because Islam seeks to take over the United States, not because we want to impose our will or Sharia law on anybody, but simply because we do understand that the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudi Arabians, we understand that they did monstrous things, and they did it in their own right, purportedly in the name of Islam. And we want to build this center, and we want this center to have a prayer room in it so that peaceful, American, patriotic, practicing Muslims can have a place specifically to come to pray for the souls of the murdered.
That would be to their credit, absolutely, and it's something that they should have thought of a long time ago when this thing first started. Now that, my friend, therein lies wisdom.
We intend to pray not only for the Muslims who died, there are over 100 of them, not counting the criminals. We intend to pray for the Buddhists, we intend to pray for the Hindus, we intend to pray for the Christians. We intend to pray for the atheists. We intend to pray.
Unfortunately, but it's not an interfaith center, is it?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Well, okay, it's not an interfaith center, but its board of directors is entirely and wholly ecumenical.
Okay. Well, I think that they should very quickly make that known. And, you know,
but again, some of this has to do with the question of the knobs and the speakers that David from Maine was talking about a little bit ago, Jim, because it has been made known. I mean, I'm sitting here in the middle of the mountains of West Virginia, and I know that it has an ecumenical interfaith board of directors. It's got a Christian on the board of directors. There's a Jew. There are Muslims. I know this, and we're talking about it here. But the problem is the right wing owns the access to the vast majority of those speakers, and as David noted, has the knob turned up to 11.
Well, absolutely, they do. And the key to that is they have the money to do it.
Yeah, and they have the money to do it, and they own the speakers.
Exactly. And that's what's going to come out of those speakers is what their money will pay for. And that's just the way things are in this country.
But, you know, I think the larger point that I'm trying to reach, Jim, is that no matter how hard the proponents of the Cordoba House might try, those people to whose baser instincts the right wing so successfully and relentlessly appeals don't care, because they are not going to be swayed by logic or reason away from their bigotry. Sometimes, and you and I know this far better with regard to Southern bigotry, Southern prejudice, Southern race hate, sometimes you just have to let the generation of the evil bastards die off.
Well, you know what Khrushchev said about that? He said there are some mistakes that only the grave will correct.
and we may be looking at them. And the only way I see to make this error correct is by building. And I can't believe I'm sitting here arguing in favor of building a religious structure. It makes me feel real creepy. But the only way to do it is to build it and let it be a structure of peace. And just as we do with marriage equality in Massachusetts, holler to all the rednecks and all the idiots and all the Jim Bobs and, you know, and Billy Bubs and say, hey, look at Massachusetts where the, you know, the homosexuals is getting married. Guess what their divorce rate is, Joe Bob? And let Joe Bob, what? Lower than yours in Neckville.
Well, that's true. I mean, what's the divorce rate among straight people? Over 50%?
Oh, gosh, yeah. No, Massachusetts has among the lowest divorce rates in the country, if not the lowest.
But if you ever find a divorce situation among a same-sex couple, that's going to be Trump. Who was it? Melissa, who was the pop star?
Melissa Etheridge.
Who was it?
Melissa Etheridge. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, Melissa Etheridge. Thank you. When she and her partner had decided they had made a mistake and gone the wrong way, oh boy, that was just all over TMZ.
No, see?
Everywhere. As if to say, well, see what we said? This don't work. We were right.
This yeah. Exactly.
My friend, I have never in my life seen this country so polarized and people so lacking in civility and the ability to simply just live and let live. I honestly have never seen such meanness.
But, Jim, it's not accidental meanness.
And hate.
It is fostered meanness. It is cultivated meanness. It's meanness that's been grown in a garden under lamps in a hothouse, lovingly tended.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, fed very well with chicken guano and roofing shingles. If you wanted to grow the biggest plants in the world for marijuana, you know.
Yep. Hear, hear.
Or any other thing.
Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate your observations.
Well, they're not much, but anyway, it's simply just a modest contribution to the conversation. But like I say, I did enjoy your conversation with Mr. Bourdain. Okay?
Thank you kindly, Jim. You have a good night.
My best to your wife.
Thank you. Bye now.
Thanks.
And that's Jim calling from here in West Virginia. Tell you what, it's about 27 and a half minutes before the hour. I hope those of you who are still blinking lights are still there. Couple of lines open if you want to help finish out the program, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. And in honor of the Wilson brothers, one of them having gone on, Ron just sent along a little something from the Gap Band for us. Gap Band, you dropped a bomb on me. Right here on the horn. I'm Bob.
You dropped a bomb on me, but
I hadn't heard that song in forever, and I'd forgotten. It's what a great party tune that is. 24 minutes before the hour. This is the Horn on Bob. Monday evening. Program reminder for those of you who may have missed it. No shows tomorrow or Wednesday. Possibly Thursday. Depends on how things shake out with Agnes's surgery situation. We'll find out if she's at, we thought she was having it Wednesday. Now we're finding out if she's having it Wednesday or a week from Wednesday. So we're out of the loop for Tuesday and Wednesday shows. Let's see. Yeah, Jim had the same response. Lord, how many good times and days past did I dance to the tune of that song? R.I.P. to the writer. Indeed, indeed. Gosh, I hope you guys are still there. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's Richard, Bob.
Hey, Richard, you're still there.
I've been on hold for an hour.
Bless your heart.
Hey, how you doing? What's with Agnes having surgery?
She's got some surgery that has to be done, and no getting around it. And it's it's either going to go down this Wednesday or a week from Wednesday.
Oh, okay.
She's a real trooper about this kind of stuff. I sit around and, you know, sort of chew my fingernails and drum my fingers. But that's just how I am with doctors. Pardon?
Is it a big issue?
She'll be out of commission for a little bit.
Okay. Well, my doctor can't see a doctor. Speaking of medical things, my doctor's on Social Security. I'm sorry, he's on Medicare.
Yeah.
And he can't see a doctor because doctors are not accepting Medicare now.
Jesus, what a rotten way to go about physician heal thyself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. See, payment compensation for doctors went down. It's been reduced by the government. And we now have doctors who won't see Medicare patients, or more of them. And he has, Medicare is disgusting because it doesn't pay for the whole thing. It's just another crappy 80-20 plan. You know, it's not like England here with this. We don't need to have Medicare as a model for everybody. We need the VA as a model for everybody.
Yes, I do see the difference. Absolutely.
Yeah, I have a friend who was in the military, and he had been buying health insurance for years, not realizing that he didn't need it. He could have just, activated his VA benefits. And finally, his life was up against the wall, and he started using it, and he's delighted. He is delighted with the service that he gets from the VA. know, and they pay for everything. So the thing is that my doctor, of course, with Medicare as an 80-20 plan, Medicare pays 80% of something, and you have to buy coverage on the private sector for that other 20%. And the nature of his insurance is that he has to utilize the other carrier first, and the other carrier here is Medicare, you see. So he's out.
Oh, geez.
It's as simple as that. And, you know, he works for my county health system, which I'm involved with, and that's even more irony because the county health department does see everybody. They do have, I mean, they take the low compensation that the private sector doctors won't. So it's just funny. I don't know. I mean, here we have all these people are screaming and hollering about Social Security and Medicare, and I'm saying Medicare is not adequate. It's not good enough. But that's
That's kind of like me arguing that the problem with Social Security is not that the retirement age is too low. It's that the retirement age is too high.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it is, indeed. Or at least, you know, when I went on Social Security myself, they had already advanced the age, which I didn't appreciate. But, you know, a couple issues on my mind. I went to see George Miller, my congressman, and he's been a good guy in terms of his voting record. To see him was a very yin-yang sort of an event.
Mixed emotions?
Yes, very mixed emotions. He has these public events. This one was in the city of Richmond, which is down the hill from me, and he always does it on really short notice. Like you can't get your life set.
No. If you're somebody who has a reputation as being a liberal or semi-liberal congressman, those public appearances, you gotta notice it up, get there and get out before the teabaggers can come up and start shooting.
Well, but not in Richmond, California.
You think you ain't got teabaggers? You got teabaggers.
No, we do. We do have teabaggers, but it was really funny. One of our little independent papers did a little survey. You know, they went around looking at the websites, and other public locations for their stuff. And he found there was very few of these teabaggers. They were all, it was like the same people posting in multiple places. It was like five people, you know. And that was all around the Bay Area. So, I don't think that's it.
Well, you say you went to see him. Was he, I mean, did you get to speak with him?
Yes, I did. I did. First I got into a little bit of a fight with one of his workers because I have an issue about political robocalls.
Oh, so do I.
Which he's done, and the woman ridiculed me. She was somebody on his staff, you know, and I've called his offices and complained about it. You know,
yeah.
That lot.
And you were ridiculed over not liking robocalls?
Yes.
So what? They've got a robocall fan club? Because I don't know anybody that likes them, Richard.
I know that. Yeah. But, you know, this is one of his staffers. The other thing was that he wasn't there to listen to people. He was there only to take questions. So you had to submit whatever you wanted to say in the form of a question. So he's not listening. Well, a woman got up behind me, an old lady, and she complained. She didn't ask him a question. She said, under this law that passed, I'm stuck with this as a, you know, I have no hope about my future with this and blah, blah. You know, she just reeled out a list of negative consequences to what the legislators had done that affected her. Miller who has always had the appearance of a pretty easygoing kind of guy, lit into her. He attacked her, you know, and my first response was, hey, wow, this guy's got some fire in him, you know, he's a fighter, cool. And then I realized, you know, uh-oh, what's he doing? He's attacking his own constituent. What the hell?
How democratic. You know, don't attack the teabaggers. Attack one of your own base. Oh, that's so us, Richard. It's so us.
And he turned red, Bob. His face turned red. The thing was, you know, I'm a sound person. I'm a musician. I'm strange. Sometimes I will not be paying so much attention to words as how they're delivered. So I don't remember what he said to her. I just remember the energy behind it.
The pitch?
Watching what he was doing. That's what I was, you know, I was focusing on that. It's like when I listen to vocal music often, I'm listening to the music, I'm not hearing the words. That's how I'm wired. And so in this case, it was like I was just reacting to the energy that he was putting out. And I honestly don't remember anything that he said. In fact, I made a statement, but I phrased it as a question. And my concern was about political corruption. And, and I ended my spiel with, what is to be done? You see, now we have a question. And the guy, what he was doing, I guess he was campaigning. You know, he's up for election. And everything he said practically was bragging about, oh, we've done this and we've done that, we've achieved this and we fought for that, you know. And he faced me, and I have no idea what he said, you know. I just saw his lips flapping, and I knew that he wasn't addressing my concerns. So, and then afterwards, I went outside, and I talked with the woman who he had attacked. And she gave me a little flyer for the Peace and Freedom Party and asked me if I'd like to be a candidate. So this is a pretty strange event. And I came away from this, you know, with the thought, I do not like this man. And that's the paradox, Bob.
You saw someone who was vastly different from who you thought was there.
Yeah, or would be, you know, and
well, I mean, you know, you're a fairly phlegmatic guy. I mean, you know, you're not going to stand there and scream. We've been talking for a long time on this program, and I just don't see you getting all red faced at your congressman. But the thing is, it sounds to me like he got there red faced, and the thing is, that's where the Democrats all are now. Even in a friendly audience, they feel like they're under fire to defend themselves.
Yeah, well, that, yes, I think you got a point there, because he was. Everything he said, you know, and I want him to listen. You know, the thing is, I want him to hear me say, I like you, you've done great stuff, George, and I want you to be Dennis Kucinich. And at least if you're not going to be Kucinich, please support everything he puts out there, you know. And, of course,
I wish I'd known you were going, because I would have loved to have seen you ask him, you know, I know you're pals with Nick Ray Hall. Why can't you get that guy to move on mountaintop removal?
Well, is he?
Oh, yeah, he and Ray Hall are great pals.
Oh, Ray Hall isn't that great. And, you know, Miller has put forth
mine safety legislation. He did it in conjunction with Ray Hall,
Bob,
yes.
And he has nothing to gain from that.
No, George Miller and Nick Ray Hall are great pals.
Well, I'm stumped. I'm stumped. Here's a guy who, I mean, he's got almost the best voting record in the whole Congress, you know, and I don't like him. And I'm stuck.
Wow, that he really put you off.
He really did. He really did. And yet I will vote, you know, I'm undoubtedly going to vote for him.
Yeah, you know what you're going to do, even though you don't want to, yeah.
I started what I said by acknowledging that his seat is safe.
Oh, he didn't like that.
Well, maybe. I don't know. He yacked at me. He looked right at me. You know, I was only a few feet away from him. He yacked at me for about, you know, 7 minutes straight, and I have no idea what he said. let me jump to another interesting issue. You know, I think we need WPA again.
If you go over to BartCop.com today, he's got a link there to that animation where it shows unemployment spreading across the United States. And it, you know, it looks like, Jesus, Richard, it looks like some sort of, it looks like the animation of some sort of locust infestation, okay? And the fact of the matter is, if you watch that animation, and I'm sort of loading the BartCop page now because I want to tell you how far down to go to see it. But the whole Laura Schlesinger. I know. It's about halfway, at least halfway down the page, and it just says. Creepy 30-second video. Watch unemployment strangle America.
Yeah.
And if you watch this video, you can't come away with anything, Richard, save the fact that the CCC and the WPA may wind up being all that's left. If we don't do that, we're going to lose the country. And I don't mean I don't mean politically, Richard.
I understand. I have a personal involvement with this to some degree. I want to take a couple of minutes to talk about it. Let me just lay the groundwork here. There are some WPA remnants around where I live. Do you have any in West Virginia that you know of?
You mean buildings and structures and stuff?
Yeah.
Hell yeah, our entire state park system.
That's it. Well, there's a park near me. It's now part of our regional park district. It's called Alvarado Park, and it's, let's see, I can't remember whether it's in Richmond or San Pablo, but it's got just a tremendous amount of stonework in it, bridges, and interesting lamp standards, you know, these poles made out of stones.
Yeah.
Once had lamps on the top. And this stonework was all done by Italian stonemasons who were out of work. And it's, you know, all these years later and this stuff is just still there and it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. My father worked for WPA. My father was a fine artist. And, he was hired to make paintings. And if he needed a model, he called up the agency, and they sent a model to him to paint. And if he needed art supplies, he got a chit, and he went to an art supply store, and he just walked out with the stuff. And I don't know if you know about this, but art supplies are really, really expensive.
Always have been, always will be.
Yeah, and they have to be, you know, because they're really a lot of custom-made stuff with low volume. So... And I have to say that during his whole life, this was the best period for him economically as an artist because the government just bought his stuff. You know, they bought his paintings and
yeah.
They used them. They put them in post offices and schools and, you know, God knows where they went. There was a warehouse fire and a lot of my father's paintings were burned and the records of where all the artists' work was burned as well. So there's tons of WPA paintings out there that nobody knows where they are. And the Smithsonian called up my father and said, hey, you know, we want to do a retrospective on the WPA artists. Can you tell us where your works are? And, you know, my father said, he said, I was hoping you could tell me.
Oh.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people don't know, Richard, that the WPA... And the CCC, particularly the WPA, if I recall correctly, did tremendous work in fostering the arts.
Mm.
Orson Welles, John Houseman, the Harlem Theater Project, I believe it was called. And you know, there are beautiful murals inside the Department of Justice building.
No, I didn't know that.
They're exquisite, and the right wingers hate them.
Well, they killed the theater project.
Yeah, but right wingers hate those murals a lot because they manifest the. They say that they're praising communist values. Because you've got paintings painted by people who are watching people work. Because part of that painting was to sort of glorify what was being done.
Yes, yes.
And it was a glorious thing to see people and government working together for common betterment. And that's one of those things, Richard, that the right wing cannot tolerate, cannot bear, cannot stand, is the idea that we might actually invest emotionally and intellectually in our government again. They have spent a generation, Richard, telling us that government doesn't work, that government is the enemy. You know, whether it was George Wallace or Ronald Reagan saying, get the government off my back.
Yes, indeed.
When the government was on their backs.
This was a good time for the arts.
Yeah, Ronald Reagan picked that straight up from George Wallace, and what George Wallace meant when he said, get the government off our back, was quit making us send the black kids to school. And that's all it ever means. Hey, Richard, I got one more blinker here I want to try to hit, but this has been great.
Okay.
All right, you take care.
Thanks, man. Bye.
Bye now. Richard calling from Richmond, California. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey. Listen, so if you, came across some Catholics who were, you know, wanting to build something, you say, oh, no, you guys are a bunch of perverts, you know, you can't build anything, be gone.
Right.
I mean, would that ever happen?
No.
Right. And so, to me, I think I understand what Jim was saying, but I think it's key to put into practice what is said in the Constitution and other founding documents or whatever. Private property, freedom of religion equals I can build whatever the fuck I want. And the idea that we got to compromise somehow because of what? It's Muslims? I mean, the implications are just stunning and very disturbing to me.
Yeah, they are because... And that's the question you constantly have to ask. Do these people realize, Jesus, I hate it when I'd even do it about them. The right wing, do they realize that they are inherently cognitively dissonant? Or do they just don't care?
Well, no, it's just the absurdity of, like, the whole Catholic analogy. Of course, you know, some of what their members do are despicable, but I can't make the leap to ban them from establishing a mission or a place of worship behind it. At least, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I have issues with these religious institutions, but just for the sake of argument. So how am I going to assume that because it has a Muslim flavor, I have to connect it to 9/11, which equals bad?
Right. Collective guilt. That's the thing. Once we've taken that step, that's one of those camel's nose under the tent things. Once we establish collective guilt for a set of people, for whatever reason, it begins to be quite easy to, A, kill them, and, B, to find the next group that we're going to make collectively guilty. Oh, wait, I'm a liberal. I know a little about this.
Well, no, it's absurd. And it's just sort of another thing that's really despicable is the Anti-Defamation League, that whole business.
Oh, yeah, where we have to accept people's, bigotry is irrational, but sometimes we just have to accept it.
No, but there's also another foreign policy aspect to this, is that these freaks need to demonize, they need to have Americans continue to demonize Muslims to justify their policy in Israel. I mean, you can make that.
Well, you know, riddle me this, Sandra. Why is it that Haaretz, and, you know, I mean, not the New York Times, not the Post, not the the Daily News, nothing. Why is it that Haaretz is reporting, and I'm not trying to create any suspicion or any of that creepy crap, but why is Haaretz the newspaper that's reporting that the leaders of the Cordoba House Project, and these are their words, will soon back down agreeing to move to a new site? Why is that coming out of Haaretz?
Well, see, that's what I'm saying. I mean, no, if you start, you know, you can sort of...
Why is that in an Israeli newspaper in the first place?
Right, exactly. And it's like the sort of... No. That whole aspect of it is really quite intriguing and disturbing to me. It's like, oh, once again, the real deal shows its ugly head. I mean, the domestic concerns are, like, frightening enough. But to conflate this into that whole Israel-American dynamic.
Yeah, could we please not do that?
Oh, God, no, I can really do without that. And I just, you know, the whole thing is disturbing. And the thing with Obama that's really bizarre is, like you said, Friday was a hella strong statement, kind of knocked me back. I'm like, where am I, you know? And I'm thinking, great. But then, of course, there's some equivocation later on, right? And like you said, what was the point? If you're going to take a stand like that, when there's no political, when the political cost can be quite high, go ahead and finish it off. Otherwise, no need to say anything at all.
I don't get it.
And I just didn't get it. Anyway, I know your show is over with, but I just, you know, I just thought that the whole thing is just so bizarre, and it's really scary, you know, how mesmerized this administration is to the huge right-wing media. I guess that's what happens when, I don't know if it was you or David who said, we don't have one, so that's their lot.
Well, and again, just to sort of drive that tack a little deeper, we don't have one because they never thought they might want one.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, yeah, it's definitely at play, you know, the whole media thing again, yet again.
Always is, Sandra, always is.
Yeah, anyway, I know you're done.
Got to roll out of here. Sorry, we'll talk soon.
Oh, no, and, you know, best to Agnes, and I hope that all works out.
Thank you very kindly. Thank you.
I
appreciate it. Take care, Sandra. Bye now. And thus we come to the end of a very enjoyable Monday show. It's about a minute past, so I'm overdue, but I'm out of here. Thanks to Anthony Bourdain for joining us this evening. He's a real good sport to do that, and I appreciate it. Thanks to all of you who make all of this happen via your contributions over the course of the weekend. We are halfway through August now, and we are nowhere near $1,250. We're at about $850-900 as of this conversation. We go forward trying to raise $2,500 a month to keep the White Rose streaming going, as well as everything that it takes to keep things going here. Thanks to those of you who do contribute. It is much appreciated. Thank you to our chat room moderator, Lottie. Thank you to Gene and Susan, our news ninjas. Thanks to Texas Betsy, our blogger. Our Southeast correspondent is Matt Osborne at Osborne Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Reverbo is our op-ed columnist with a magnum opus piece coming up from Cavalcade of Crazy at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. My head writer is David in Tennessee. Please keep your best thoughts, prayers, good wishes aimed squarely at Judy Bonds. She is one of those heroes among those that I call the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Remember, no shows tomorrow or Wednesday, and we'll see what shakes out as far as Thursday is concerned. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
You're listening to the Head On Radio Network. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Get on the horn. Get on the horn. Get on the horn.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. Cold River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of West By God, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid!
Well, howdy! All right, we're all set. Usually I banter a little bit before getting into the full swing of the show, you know that. But tonight we're going to go straight to the meat of the program. Even the music's been inspected. John Fox crafted that intro in an attempt to make sure that not one single note had ever been played by either Billy Joel or the Grateful Dead, and they haven't. We're serious about this. This is a professional operation. I first became aware of Anthony Bourdain a long, long time ago on a cable network, probably not far enough away from Mr. Bourdain's liking. From the first episode, I was hooked. You know me well enough to know that No Reservations is literally the only TV show I make a conscious effort to watch. Hell, back when we were doing the horn section, I had my contract stipulate that I got Monday nights off. I actually know when No Reservations airs, and I've been known to stay up late to catch the rerun. I even sat down to an episode of Yo Gabba Gabba with my granddaughter when Tony was on. Yeah, I'm a fan. Why? Well, because in an entertainment industrial complex world awash in reality shows that are anything but, Anthony Bourdain is as much as television can be, real. So's his writing. From Kitchen Confidential through A Cook's Tour and The Nasty Bits, I've enjoyed every printed word. Even more than the television, it's proven thought-provoking. In an era when even the news, the staple of my existence, is as often vapid as it is substantive. So we come tonight to Mr. Bourdain's new book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the World of Food and the People Who Cook, out this summer from Echo Press, a HarperCollins imprint. This is much more than a food book. And Anthony Bourdain is much more than a guy who writes about food. Anthony Bourdain, welcome to the horn.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm just tickled pink. Let me ask just to get going. Medium Raw is full of observations that let readers know that you sort of suspect that what you're doing is a kind of a fleeting transient. bigger stuff out there. You've just gotten back, as I understand from your publicist, from what I hope was a relaxing and pleasant vacation. And you come back to see your beloved New York City and the rest of the country embroiled over a tempest in a teapot over the Muslim equivalent of a YMCA with lots of folks who know less than, you know, about New York than a hillbilly like me. Do you just want to run screaming back to JFK and get on the plane?
Yeah, man. I don't know. I mean, intolerance, being a territorial, intolerant, jingoistic, xenophobic, tribalism. I mean, that's something I see a lot of around the world. But it's unlovely to see, in my hometown. I mean, to his credit, our mayor has been very cool about it. To come down on the right side of the issue. Yes, of course, it's enraging it, but yes, I want to run right back to where I was. I want to go right back to Italy.
Well, it just occurred to me because there was a strange irony in the fact that, the last new episode of No Reservations that aired before this conversation, last week's episode, was Dubai.
Yeah.
And it has to, of course, you know, that's long ago old history in your book, but there has to be something odd insofar as you meet people who are really decent human beings all around the globe, and it comes out in your work. And to see this kind of thing going on in this country has got to be a little bit unsettling.
Well, like I like to say a lot, I mean, I don't have to, you know, I don't have to agree with you to like you or respect you. In fact, I could disagree violently with what you have to say, and I feel I could still sit down, have a decent...